Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Come here, Susie. You remember me? Your daddy's friend, Henry?
No, don't!
One of Queen Elizabeth's sons, Prince Andrew, has announced that he's stepping back from public duties because of what he called his ill-judged association with the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. He released a statement after an attempt to clear the air in a BBC interview broadcast on Saturday was widely deemed to have been a public relations disaster. This statement has been voiced by one of our producers.
It has become clear to me over the last few days that the circumstances relating to my former association with Jeffrey Epstein has become a major disruption to my family's work and the valuable work going on in the many organisations and charities that I am proud to support. Therefore, I have asked Her Majesty if I may step back from public duties for the foreseeable future, and she has given her permission. I continue to unequivocally regret my ill-judged association with Jeffrey Epstein. His suicide has left many unanswered questions, particularly for his victims, and I deeply sympathise with everyone who has been affected and wants some form of closure. I can only hope that in time they will be able to rebuild their lives. Of course, I am willing to help any appropriate law enforcement agency with their investigations, if required.
Various institutions and companies had already said they wanted to end or were thinking of ending their association with the prince. So what does all this mean for Prince Andrew's reputation? I spoke to our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond.
Well, it means that the pressure has become too much, that after the interview that he gave on Saturday, the reaction to that, both from the public, from commentators and from the sort of private world, the corporate interests that supported the charitable work that he was connected to. He has effectively sort of seen the way in which this is going, and it's all bad, or it was all bad. And so he says in a very open, almost emotional statement that he is stepping back from public duties for the foreseeable future. Well, he says a whole things that the sort of things he didn't say in the interview as well. He says he unequivocally regrets what he calls his ill-judged association with Jeffrey Epstein. He talks about the victims, which, again, he failed to do in the interview. He says he deeply sympathises with everyone who's been affected. And he says he will assist the appropriate law enforcement agencies with their investigations, again, which wasn't made clear in the...
Does that mean he could get on a plane and fly to the United States?
Well, we don't know at the moment. And again, it's carefully phrased. There are an awful lot of lawyers in America who are asking him to give sworn statements, to give depositions. He's not saying he's going to do that. He's saying if the FBI, the British police, the French police want a statement, then he will assist them. And that could well mean, in fact, that they come over here and take a statement.
Is this going to draw a line under the affair?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, it draws a line under it for the royal family, for the institution, for the palace, because it is taking him out of the public side. It doesn't draw a line under all the questions that still remain about why for so long he was friends with Jeffrey Epstein, about the apparent inconsistencies in the interview and various other reports of his behaviour. Though there are still questions to be asked about the affair itself. And so investigations, I'm sure, will continue, but they don't have that royal spotlight that they have had for so long.
And what does the foreseeable future mean?
I find it difficult to see how he steps back into public duties without some real form of closure, i.e. some investigative authority saying it was nothing to do with him. You know, this is going to hang over him and it's very difficult to see how it will be cleared. So this may well be the end for Prince Andrew in terms of his public duties and his public life.
Our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond. Simon Jenkins is a former newspaper editor in Britain who's written several books on the politics and history of England. Tim Franks asked him what he made of the news.
I think it's a welcome announcement. I just don't think it's terribly important. His public duties were not all that onerous. But anyway, it's the obvious response to the very embarrassing situation he finds himself in. So I think it's a sensible decision.
Do you think it's enough in PR terms to staunch the bleeding, to limit the damage that appears to have been caused as a result of his interview with the BBC?
I very much doubt that, because he's gone public with an interview in which he made some very specific comments in his own defence, admittedly, on a matter that's subject to a court case in America. So he's very exposed, and I don't see how he can, in a sense, just withdraw from it. He's vulnerable to subpoena. But it's not obviously a wise thing to do just in public relations terms.
What implications do you think all this has for the royal family, for the institution of the monarchy?
Well, I think you need to understand that Britain is pretty well unlike, if not unique, other surviving monarchies around the world, of which there are dozens, of course, in that back in the 1960s, I think most unwisely, the Queen decided to update the monarchy by making the monarchy embrace the royal family. And this was a quite specific decision to sort of collectivise the monarchy from one individual person, that was herself, to all her children. And it made it seem as if she was, I suppose, being modern. In fact, it made the monarchy vulnerable to any misbehaviour on the part of the children. It turned the children into celebrities. As celebrities, they were in the public eye. They carried out public duties. They received public subsidies. And they were inevitably going in what they got up to reflect on the monarchy itself. So it was a very high-risk thing to do. And ever since then, I would have thought she must have been regretting it. But I'm not her.
But there've been all sorts of brushes with ill fortune and bad luck and bad judgment by members of the royal family since then. I mean, one thinks of what happened in particular in the 90s, which was a very turbulent decade for the royal family. And the institution of the monarchy, just in terms of its popularity in the United Kingdom and the sort of the belief that there should still be a monarchy, that doesn't seem to have been particularly affected. Do you think that this episode could change that?
I don't think so. Every monarchy is as good as its monarch, in a sense, but on the other hand, it's a very peculiar institution to enshrine the concept of the headship of your state and your nation in an individual chosen by the lot of inheritance, of genetics. So it's in itself a kind of bizarre hangover from the Middle Ages. But given that you've got it, and given that on the whole it works, and it has got widespread public support, the most important thing, I think, is to make sure that the monarch, in a sense, is not a real person. It's the personification of the headship of state. As such, the safest way to do it is the way the Danes, the Norwegians, the Swedes do it, which is to have simply one person who is the national head of state and performs various public duties of a totally uncontroversial nature in the name of the whole state rather than a party or political leadership. And I think that's totally acceptable, provided, of course, that in some sense the individual concerned is dignified enough to reflect the headship of state. Now, when you turn it into a family, you're complicating it hugely by the nature of that family. And I think the problem with the British royal family has always been that it doesn't damage the monarchy existentially. I think the monarchy is very well entrenched in Britain. It does, in a sense, taint the concept of headship of state. And that's the problem that we've had with Prince Charles's marriage, with the other children's activities, and with Prince Andrew. It's unhelpful and complicates public life.
The author and journalist Simon Jenkins.
The stars at night are big and bright.
Deep in the heart of Texas.
The school district in Houston, Texas, faces an unprecedented move. Texas officials announced a complete takeover of one of the largest school districts in America. They announced this even though the district came very close to earning an A grade in the latest state report card. So why take it over? Houston Public Media's Laura Eisensee has the story.
This year, veteran educator Carrie Petty started a new job teaching digital media in Houston. But during his first week, he learned the state could take over the entire district, which has over 200,000 students.
And I was like, whoa, I'm half thinking a flashback of New Orleans and back home in Detroit, what happened in Detroit public schools.
Petty has taught in New Orleans and Michigan and saw states intervene there. In Houston, this threat has loomed over the nation's seventh largest district for over 2 years. But it touches Petty's school, Wheatley High, directly. So when class started, he heard even more about it.
Well, the students have been up in a frenzy. Are we opening? Are we closing? What's going on? So they're a little bit, some anxiety there. Some teachers have some anxiety.
A state law says if even one school fails state standards for five or more years, the Texas Education Commissioner must close the campus or replace the entire district's elected board. And Wheatley High, a historically black school that's produced members of Congress, prominent athletes, and celebrities, has failed seven times in a row.
My guards was up, like, we got to stay focused on this. We can't, like, sit back.
Petty says their anxiety hasn't calmed down since Commissioner Mike Morath announced this month he plans to oust the 9-member school board and appoint outside managers. One reason? Wheatley High's chronic low performance, something Morath hinted at this fall.
And the unfortunate truth is some of the schools that we have are not good enough for my kids or your kids or the kids that are in them.
Morath says another reason for his decision, state investigators found widespread misconduct among board members. That's a major reason why the Houston business community backs the takeover. Here's Bob Harvey with the Greater Houston Partnership addressing members.
We think the Houston Independent School District's board's long-term failure to consistently support all of our schools, all of our kids, warrants new leadership at HISD.
But some teachers and advocates say Houston voters have already fixed that problem when they elected 4 new board members this November. They made it clear at a recent community meeting at Wheatley High they want to choose their own representatives.
You're taking the control of our local school district from the people who don't have a voice.
Michelle Williams has taught for 20 years. She asked, who will hold appointed managers accountable?
What if we don't like them? Then what process do we have?
Texas education administrators promise new managers will get robust training and support, and they'll reflect Houston's diverse community. That hasn't convinced Williams.
I don't see how it's going to work.
Yeah.
I see in our future the district getting worse because the teachers who are committed, the parents who were committed, may not stay because of this sanction.
The Houston School Board and the teachers union are trying to stop the takeover in court. In a joint federal lawsuit, their attorneys claim it disenfranchises Hispanic and black voters in the district. The union has also called the takeover a way to privatize public education with more charter schools. Still, teachers like Carrie Petty say they plan to focus on their students.
No, I'm not going to walk out of here. Trust me that. I'm still going to be here. Teach every day like it's in my last, so I'm not going anywhere.
But he wants answers, like what would a state board put at the top of their agenda? For NPR News, I'm Laura Eisensee in Houston.
I watched a white riot in Portland, Oregon on television the other night.
Last week, the FBI reported that hate crime violence in the country is at a 16-year high. In 2018, there were more than 4,500 such crimes, assaults that were motivated in part or in whole by racial, ethnic, or religious bias, as well as discrimination against gender and sexual orientation. The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights also reported that the highest percentage of all reported hate incidents since the 2016 election were in elementary and secondary schools. NewsHour special correspondent Charlene Hunter-Galt looks at how this problem has played out in Northwest Oregon and how teachers are learning to intervene earlier. It's part of our education coverage, Making the Grade, and the latest in our Race Matters series looking at solutions to racism. A warning, this story contains some offensive and troubling images.
At schools just like South Ridge High near Portland, Oregon, educators say white nationalists are making inroads, but also infiltrating nationwide from online. They're co-opting otherwise innocent images like helicopters, cartoon frogs, and the OK sign, incorporating them widely into racist images and videos. And they're showing up alongside more familiar hate symbols in unlikely places.
KCALine Orange County reporter Stacey Butler is live tonight in Newport Beach with that story.
A swastika made out of red Solo cups at a high school party in California. Apparent Nazi salutes in a prom photo in Wisconsin. The OK sign, which some use as a hand sign for white power, flashed in high school yearbooks at schools near Chicago, forcing costly reprints.
Okay. It's not specifically alt-right, it just can be used in that way, but it can also be used in many other ways.
Southridge High School senior Tristan Madron says many young people are sucked in with dark humor.
People treat it almost in a joking manner,
like
black people are ruining the country, you know, stuff like that. I've seen new iterations of the N-word.
Nigga!
They're treating it like, haha, this is a funny joke. What if we drag someone by a car across the street?
Online forums can often pull students in deeper. One student who didn't want to be identified told us that a friend even communicated with the Christchurch, New Zealand shooter before he murdered 51 people, the student thinking it was all a joke.
It was in between the first and second shootings, but he didn't know that this was happening. And he was like, the second shooting's commenced or whatever, like blah, blah, blah. And then he heard about it and he was like, wait, like, that was like real? That was, you know, something he was telling all of us.
At South Ridge itself, students recently spray-painted the football field with swastikas. School officials investigated but never found the culprits, and some students were left feeling uneasy.
It's like, I'm Jewish and I'm also black, so seeing that kind of stuff and knowing that I go to school with these people who don't like a part of me scares me.
You're the target oftentimes. You're the target demographic when people want to change the future.
That's Patrick Griffin, a Southridge social studies teacher who started looking for ways to fight back when offensive stereotypes made their way into his own classroom. He soon found a toolkit online called Confronting White Nationalism in Schools, written in part by Lindsay Schubiner of the nonprofit Western States Center. There have been over 5,000 requests for the toolkit from educators around the world.
Patrick Griffin and Lindsay Schubiner, thank you so much for joining us. And I want to start with you, Patrick. Can you tell me what was it that initially set off an alarm bell for you when you heard things that were frightening or threatening?
For me, I guess it comes in several parts. All of these instances of violence housed in an ideology of white nationalism, I see it affecting my kids. And they're talking about it, and some of them are scared about it, and some of them are scared about talking about it.
Like what, for example?
So we might be having conversations about nationalism in my class. And so we would be having these conversations, and these conversations were happening within the current political climate, and so inherently we'd start talking about current events and start talking about the most recent presidential election and whatnot. And I'd have some students whose faces would fall and whose eyes would disengage. On the other hand, I've got other students who are feeling safe to engage with the conversation in a healthy way. I've also had students who were feeling safe to engage in the conversation in some unhealthy ways because they were really happy about the growing movements of taking America back to a very white place. And so I put the word out, hey, does anybody have any resources that I could use? And that's how I came across the toolkit.
Well, Lindsay, this is where you come in. There does seem to be, by all accounts, a rise in white supremacist speech. How is it that you came to deal with that, and what did you come up with?
We know that white nationalists and alt-right movements are intentionally recruiting young people. The editor of a neo-Nazi website has written that he designs his website to recruit children as young as 11 years old. We're talking about young people who don't yet have fully formed views and opinions about the world, and that's a big reason why white nationalists and alt-right groups are working to recruit them.
So you've come up with this kit, a kit that you've used in your classes. What does this kit do?
So this toolkit provides some context and some guidance around the issue of white nationalist and alt-right recruitment of young people. And it also provides a number of scenarios, possible things that might happen in a school community.
It also contains definitions and a roadmap to alt-right symbols to help teachers, administrators, and community members strip the secrecy from white nationalism.
So how have you used the toolkit?
So I like using the toolkit in my classrooms with my lesson plans, whether it be talking about definitions or scenarios. The toolkit has been useful in conversations in the hallways with students as they're coming up to me to talk about, hey, Mr. Griffin, what do you think about this or that meme or whatnot or whatever's current in their life? We're also using the toolkit to create advisory lesson plans that the entire school body, student body, will be using.
One thing the toolkit tries to do is empower students that they do have a voice, but it's not their responsibility to take this on. There are adults in the community, and it's our job to take this on.
And do your students, the students that you're talking with, do they understand, especially those who are embracing these white nationalist tropes, how do you deal with them and prevent them from moving into the direction of violence?
If a kid is going through that, then you've got to make them feel known, valued, loved, part of the community, because so much of this is this isolationism that they're experiencing, while also educating some of their ignorance about the greater context of it.
Reaching the students in your classroom doesn't address what they're getting at home, so how do you deal with that?
For people who are already deeply involved in white nationalism, this toolkit is not for them. But it also, we hope, will help create communities that are openly talking about issues of white nationalism, white supremacy, racial justice, and reinforcing values that include everyone.
To both of you, how hopeful are you that the kind of extremism that this toolkit is trying to address can be contained or even defeated? Are you hopeful at all? Or is it just moving too fast?
I have a lot of reasons to not be hopeful, I guess. That said, I have a lot of reasons to be hopeful too. And it is that these kids are willing to engage in these conversations in a nuanced manner that I don't think some previous generations have been as willing to engage in. And so if you just keep doing that, eventually you get an entire new generation in charge, and I suppose there's a lot of hope there.
Well, let's hope that's where hope lies.
Yeah, right.
Let's hope for the hope.
Yeah, sometimes that's all you got.
Well, Patrick Griffin and Lindsay Shubiner, thank you so much for joining us, and all the best with your work in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Why haven't you learned anything?
Disturbing allegations tonight of bullying at Admiral Farragut Academy in St. Petersburg.
Just last week, we told you about a case alleged bullying and racism at the school involving a minority student. School officials strongly denied those allegations.
But now another family has come forward telling 8 on Your Side their child was also the victim of bullying. Jeff Patterson joins us live from Admiral Farragut tonight with this story.
Good evening, Stacy and Keith. This new lawsuit lays out a case of racist language and physical bullying. But like the previous case, the school claims it never happened.
He stood out because of his uniform, the pride he took in his uniform.
Stacy Hughes is proud of her son, and he was proud to go to school at Admiral Farragut Academy and play football here. But that changed.
We noticed that he... appetite was going down, didn't want to sleep.
The Hughes tell me they eventually learned their son was being bullied at school when he tried out for lacrosse.
He was told that, why don't you go back to playing football? In the N-word,
don't play lacrosse. And you're not going to come out here and outshine us.
The Hughes say the school did nothing to help their son.
As far as them acknowledging it and trying to do something about it, no.
In a statement, the headmaster of the school told 8 on Your Side, while we have not seen the complaint, this matter involves a student who was dismissed from Admiral Farragut Academy 2 years ago for violating our school's code of conduct. 4 months later, the student's family contacted the St. Petersburg Police Department to allege that he had been bullied and hazed while he was a student here. The statement goes on to say police did not find any evidence to support the claims. But the family's attorney says the evidence is there.
What they don't realize is that we have had corroborating witnesses come forward who will, under oath, say this did happen.
The Hughes say their son was attacked by other students with lacrosse sticks in the locker room and stomped on by some of those students who had their cleats on. Keith?
Well, Jeff, what's troubling at this point is we've now reported on two cases involving a minority student and bullying, and you think there could be more that we haven't reported on yet.
I'm told there are other families who have similar claims, but they are afraid to come forward because they want their student to graduate. Well, there's strength in numbers, and perhaps they will come forward now. Keith?
Jeff Patterson reporting live in St. Petersburg. Thank you, Jeff. And you can see Jeff's original story with this other family that's suing Admiral Farragut Academy over these allegations that their child was bullied. You can do that by going to our WFLA app.
Remember, no one is going to treat you special just because you are black.
Hateful graffiti, racist slurs shouted at students, the sharing of a white supremacist manifesto. A dozen racist incidents are roiling Syracuse University.
Justice! Now!
For days, students have staged a sit-in. The FBI is now investigating the reported racist messages and hate crimes. And now the chancellor of Syracuse has signed a list of demands at the request of protesters. Casey Darnell is news editor at the independent student newspaper, The Daily Orange. Casey, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So what do students want that they feel like they're just not getting from their university right now?
They want to feel like the university actually cares about their safety and making them feel welcome on campus. They want mandatory diversity training for faculty and staff. They want stricter consequences for hate speech and actions like racist graffiti. And they want diversity and inclusion to be more than just buzzwords.
Can you tell us what's led to this moment? What are these incidents we're talking about?
So exactly 2 weeks ago, students found racist graffiti against black and Asian people in a dorm building. It took the university 4 days to officially announce that it happened while students had already heard about it. And ever since then, there's been more reports of racist graffiti. On Saturday, there was fraternity members involved in yelling the N-word at a black woman on campus. And then on Tuesday, what really pushes into national spotlight was a alleged white supremacist manifesto from the shooter in the Christchurch massacre that was supposedly shared to students on campus.
Has the university done anything to protect students and beef up security?
Ever since the first delayed communication about racist graffiti, the campus police has been informing us over and over again about different incidents, so it's kind of felt like this just flood of information about hate crimes. And the university has beefed up security across campus. The state police are involved. There's just a lot more security around campus now.
And the FBI has now gotten involved. What exactly are they looking at?
The FBI got involved after the white supremacist manifesto was allegedly spread or shared in an online forum. And they're also investigating an anti-Semitic email sent to a professor on campus that made reference to the Holocaust.
And so this forum last night with students and university officials, what was it like in the room? How tense was it?
It gave me chills. Hundreds of students walked into this huge chapel wearing all black. There was only a few minutes into the forum when the chancellor spoke, and he said he couldn't immediately address all their demands. He would have to talk to more people and consider things. And they immediately got up, walked out, and were chanting, "Resign, sign or resign," over and over again.
So we should say you're a journalist and you're a student at Syracuse. What has this felt like for you in this climate?
It's been draining both physically and emotionally. I haven't been to class in the past 2 weeks because I'm covering the sit-in nonstop or managing my staff's coverage of it. Me and another reporter, we heard about the swastika written in the snow near a student apartment complex, and we ran down across campus to find it, and it's just really visceral to see a swastika in the snow in front of you, knowing that someone did that to be hateful. It's just really draining to experience these things and see them firsthand.
Wow. And I mean, it's on campus, the scene? Like, does it feel different than a college campus we might be used to?
Yeah, as there's been more and more incidents, and some people feel like there's been an escalation with this white supremacist manifesto allegedly being shared, students have been leaving campus early, people have been afraid to go out at night, to go out alone. No one's really walking around campus anymore at times when it's normally packed. It's just been really hard for everyone.
Casey Darnell is news editor at the independent student newspaper, The Daily Orange, and a student at Syracuse University. Casey, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And we do want to say we reached out to Syracuse University to request an interview with the chancellor, and so far he has declined.
Well, see, again, the people who classify themselves as white are not happy with their appearance. Now, they've taught us to be unhappy about our appearance. You see, but they're very unhappy about their appearance. I think there's an article in the handout about a woman who was, white woman who was in Hawaii, and she said that being around the Hawaiian people and the Asian people, and she said she was tall and white and pale. She said she felt like a freak. And so then she started getting involved in genetic science.
Scientists are reporting the first evidence that one of the most exciting medical experiments in decades appears to be working. Billions of genetically modified cells from a patient with sickle cell disease have started doing what doctors had hoped. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein has been following this patient's journey, which could have implications for millions of patients around the world. Today, Rob continues his exclusive coverage.
It's a foggy morning, and I'm waiting to meet Victoria Gray in a parking garage in downtown Nashville. Hi, Victoria.
Hi.
How are you doing? So good to see you.
It's good to see y'all, too.
Victoria just drove back to Nashville after spending some time at home with her family in Forest, Mississippi for the first time in months.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. So it's an exciting day for you, huh?
Yes, it is.
How you feeling?
I feel good. I'm hoping to get some good news today.
Good news from her doctor about whether the billions of genetically modified cells might, just might, be helping her fight sickle cell disease, which has tormented her all her life. Are you nervous at all?
No, I'm not. No.
No?
Just about the needles.
Victoria will have to get a ton of blood tests today.
TriStar Medical Group.
She checks in at the Tricentennial Medical Center in Nashville.
Can I help you?
Yes, Victoria Gray for Dr. Frangou.
Could you go ahead and sign in for me?
Okay.
As we're waiting, I notice Victoria's wearing a black sweatshirt with big letters spelling out warrior. I like your sweatshirt.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, they call sickle cell patient warriors, and I saw this shirt at Walmart, so I had to get it.
Oh, I did not know they called sickle cell patients warriors.
Yes. Because it's a constant battle you have to be to deal with it.
Sickle cell is a cruel genetic disorder that deforms red blood cells into defective sickle-shaped cells that jam up our bloodstream, wreak havoc in our body, and cause sudden attacks of what some people say is the worst pain imaginable.
I had moments where I was standing, laughing, talking with friends, and then the next thing you know, my husband had to carry me into the emergency room because I couldn't use my legs because they would hurt so bad. And when you can't help yourself, it's just one of those feelings that just make you want to give up, you know.
That just sounds unbelievably awful.
Yes, it is.
You can go on back now.
Victoria finds an empty chair, sits down, and stretches out her arm for the nurses.
All right, so you're going to feel a stick on three, okay? One, two, three, stick. All right. You should be good.
As the nurses fill one big tube after another, I asked Victoria about her homecoming a few weeks earlier, when she got to see her four kids for the first time since she spent the summer in Nashville getting treated. It was a grueling procedure.
My oldest son, when he did his double take and realized I was in the car, he took off running and he just grabbed me and held on to me. Yeah, and the twins saw me from the inside the house. They knew it was Mama.
It must have been amazing.
Yes, it's emotional for me, you know, because I love them so much. I did this for them. Yeah, so it's worth it.
The nurses are finally done after filling 16 vials.
Okay, all finished. You did great.
Thank you.
Victoria finally heads over to see her doctor.
How are you? Okay. How are you? You're doing all right?
Dr. Haider Frangoul is with the Sarah Cannon Research Institute.
Okay, great. Let's check you out. Take a deep breath for me. Deep breath. Good job. Well, you look amazing, Victoria. You look really good.
After the exam, Dr. Frangoul finally shows Victoria what she's been waiting for, the results of some of her blood tests.
So, look at this. This is very exciting.
Yes.
Are you excited about it?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I am super excited about your results today.
That's because it seems to be working. Victoria's genetically modified cells have started doing what they're supposed to be doing.
It looks like there are signs that you are starting to make fetal hemoglobin, which is very exciting for us.
Scientists use the powerful gene editing technique CRISPR to edit the DNA in Victoria's cells to make them produce a protein called fetal hemoglobin. The hope is that would turn Victoria's deformed red blood cells into normal healthy ones. And so far, nearly half the hemoglobin in her blood is fetal hemoglobin, and it's still rising. But Dr. Frangoul knows he has to be cautious.
It is still too early to celebrate. I just want to make sure this is something we watch very carefully every visit and see how things are going.
The treatment seems safe so far, and the edited cells look like they may already be helping Victoria. She hasn't needed any blood transfusion since she got the cells, hasn't had any of those awful attacks of pain.
And you haven't been in the hospital since I last saw you, correct?
No.
That's good. Excellent. Perfect.
And so is that because of the procedure, preserves of the cells?
Well, we are hoping it is. Again, it is too early to figure it out, but this is extremely encouraging. We are very happy that she didn't have any ER visits. She hasn't had any hospital stays since we've done the procedure, so this is really good.
And is that unusual? Would you have expected to usually have a pain episode in this period?
Of course, like with the time that passed by, I would at least have had something, you know.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, it is for me. It's special, especially coming up on the holidays, because sometimes I would be in the hospital on Christmas. And so I'm looking forward to the whole new life for all of us.
Doctors will have to follow Victoria for years and study more patients to answer the big questions. Are the cells really helping patients live healthier lives? Will they keep working? Will they keep working safely? And will they actually help patients live longer?
This will be life-changing, not only for Victoria, but for many sickle cell patients. Because if this is determined to be safe and effective, I think it can be transformative for patients with sickle cell disease.
Victoria calls her edited cells her super cells. So your super cells seem to be working.
Yeah, they seem to be super after all, huh? Yes.
Victoria is already doing things she could never do before, like go to one of her son's football games for the first time.
You know, the simple things in life, I don't really want anything extravagant. I just want a simple life with my family, you know, people that I love and people that love me, and just live, you know?
Rob Stein, NPR News, Nashville.
This can be the beginning of something special.
Newsday is reporting an explosive 70-page long investigation of housing discrimination on Long Island. The series published yesterday and today shows what the newspaper calls the most segregated suburb in the country is getting even more segregated due to the behavior of real estate agents who employ a variety of strategies to keep white areas white and black neighborhoods black. Joining me in the studio is project editor Arthur Brown, and reporter Olivia Winslow is on the phone. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much, Jamie.
Thank you.
First of all, this was a huge undertaking. You had to train testers, use undercover cameras, and put in 3 years' worth of work and investigation. Tell us what you found. Arthur, first to you.
Well, the 3 years of effort produced a unique insight into the hidden discrimination that minorities face in house hunting on Long Island. There was no other way to do this than to execute what they call testing of real estate agents, which means pairing a white and a black tester, a white and an Hispanic tester, white and an Asian tester, and asking them to visit a real estate agent to present the same credentials, to make the same request, and then to gauge what happened.
Those are the old school methods used by the NAACP and others in the 1960s and 70s to prove up housing discrimination. Olivia, reporting the project, what did you find in terms of the numbers?
Well, we had 86 pair tests, and overall, we found problematic tests in 34 of them, or 40%. Black testers faced evidence of discrimination at a higher rate than the others, 49%. Among Hispanics, the problematic rate was 39%, and of our Asian testers, 19% were problematic.
I want to play an example of what your testers experienced. Here's some audio of an agent who's talking to a white applicant, a man who has a pregnant wife, explaining what steps he should take before deciding to buy a house in a particular neighborhood.
I can't say anything, but I encourage you, I want you to go there at 10 o'clock at night with your wife by day. Go to that 7-Eleven.
So why is the agent telling an applicant to go to a 7-Eleven at 10 p.m. at night discriminatory, Olivia?
Well, it's an indication of what she thinks the tester or the customer could find out about the neighborhood, the type of people who might live in that neighborhood.
Are we talking about class and race?
We don't want to read too much into the mind of the real estate agent because that's not our purview. Mm-hmm. But we can look at what this particular real estate agent said. And she actually said that she can't use the word steer, which is the term for directing a minority or white buyers to different neighborhoods, but she would say that she would educate people about the type of individuals who lived in a particular neighborhood, which is not within the purview of what is permitted for a real estate agent to do.
Olivia, you put the testers in a room and had them share their experiences. That must have been very moving.
It was. One of our testers, a young woman who was brought up in Elmont, which hugs the Nassau County border with Queens, she was black and Hispanic, and one of the agents that she talked to said for her, Elmont was okay, but with her white matched pair, told the white tester, to stay away from Elmont. So, and that caused the black tester to tear up. She says, I think it's a nice town. So, yes, it brought out emotional responses from some of our testers.
You mentioned that Newsday, unlike some other outlets that have done similar investigations, though perhaps not as extensive, published the names of the real estate agents. And you went to the trouble of contacting the agents for a response to the investigation with letters and calling them, even sending their supervisors letters. What kind of reaction did you get, if any?
Very few commented. Most chose not to comment. In the occasional case where they agreed to comment, there were general statements about trying to uphold the fair housing law, but nobody challenged the findings, and very little attempts to explain the conduct that was just right there for everybody to see.
So then how do we explain the conduct? Why are the agents doing this? Is it endemic racism? Is it profit motive? It may be a combination of the two?
There may be a presumption that whites want to live among whites and blacks want to live among blacks and Hispanics want to live among Hispanics. But in our investigation, we focused on the 12 largest brokerage companies on Long Island, and They chose to avoid business almost entirely in the overwhelmingly minority communities of Long Island.
Which, given what you found, will shut people of color out of the white neighborhoods.
If they go to those real estate agents.
Right.
Right?
Right. Olivia, let me ask you why you think this is happening.
Well, I can't speak to individuals. Agents' beliefs, but we've had some agents come to Newsday who are involved in training other real estate agents, and they have told us that we're asked to steer by the seller or, you know, the buyer. More than one told us that.
As you mentioned in your article, the findings don't have the force of law. What are our hopes for this investigation? Might it propel civil rights agencies to take action or maybe do their own testing? Have you heard anything from elected officials? What happens next?
What would have to happen next, according to the experts with whom we've spoken, is that public agencies, the government, federal, state, local, here in New York, largely New York State, would have to fund broad-scale testing of real estate agents so that they know that somebody's going to be looking over their shoulder. Until government supports broad-scale testing, agents can continue this type of behavior to whatever extent that they want to without fear of sanction.
I've been speaking with Newsday editor Arthur Brown and reporter Olivia Winslow. My thanks to both of you for your reporting.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If I can make it there, I'm gonna make it anywhere. It's up to you, New York.
Former Mayor Michael Bloomberg has apologized for the way his administration handled the police tactic of stop and frisk, especially in communities of color. Bloomberg expressed his remorse yesterday at a church in East New York, saying he'd not fully understood the adverse effects of the practice on African Americans and Latinos. Yasmin Khan, our WNYC reporter, says those effects continue, and so she was out and about in the city today getting reaction to Mike Bloomberg's remarks. And she joins me now here in the studio. Hello.
Hi, Jamie.
So we heard a lot of political leaders say that Bloomberg's apology comes too late. What did you hear out on the street today?
I heard something similar, but people were still glad to hear an apology at all. A man named Chris Powers, who grew up in Brownsville, now lives in East New York, says you don't actually hear people in power and with that kind of platform apologizing all that much. So he appreciated that. He says it's a step. But Powers also said it can't just stop there.
My community generally is willing to forgive pretty much everything and anything if you are willing to make amends. But that's what I want to see. I want to hear more than an apology. I want to hear him make amends.
And can you sketch out the scope of the problem when he says make amends? What were some of the stop and frisk numbers? What are we correcting during the Bloomberg administration? How was the practice used?
Right. So police stops increased dramatically under Bloomberg and his police commissioner, Ray Kelly. At the peak in 2011, the NYPD recorded nearly 700,000 stops, mostly of Black and Latino New Yorkers. The NYCLU had an analysis from that time saying more Black men were stopped than there were Black men in the city population. And I think it's important to understand what that experience was like, what the actual police encounter was like. So just to give a picture, I want to play a clip from an interview that I did actually this summer with a community activist named Darian Agostini. He works with Make the Road New York, and he came of age during Bloomberg's stop and frisk. This was his routine experience during his teenage years in Crown Heights.
Police officers dumped out of unmarked cars and threw me up against walls and emptied out my book bag while I was, like, coming home from school.
So those were high-level encounters. Police also routinely stopped just to question him on the street. You know, where are you going? What are you doing here?
And then after situations like that, police like to say, don't let me see you here again, you know? Like, again, I live here. I live on this block. I live around the corner. Like, How are you going to tell me you don't want to see me again in my own neighborhood?
This was a practice Mike Bloomberg defended adamantly as mayor, and then even after he was mayor, right?
That's right. You know, he even defended it in 2013 after a federal judge ruled that the way police were utilizing stop and frisk was racially discriminatory and unconstitutional. Bloomberg said, though, at the time that stop and frisk was effective, that it was needed to get illegal guns off the street to deter crime and to deter people from carrying guns. Let's remember, though, he was a mayor who liked data, and he had data to show how it was affecting Black and Latino communities and also how the practice was not resulting in a high number of arrests or summonses.
Stop and frisk, which is supposed to be stop, question, and frisk, is still a police tool. But Yasmin, is it being used differently now?
Yeah. I mean, well, the police will say that policing has changed dramatically in the last 4 or 5 years. And there are far fewer stops. You know, so 2011, there were more than 685,000 stops. Last year, there were fewer than 12,000. So stops right. have decreased, that's for sure. But that's due in part to that federal lawsuit, which is known as the Floyd case.
Yes.
Because of that case, the NYPD is under a federal monitor. And the federal monitor actually in this last report raised concerns about underreporting now of stops. People I spoke with today say that, or they feel that racial profiling is still alive and well, whether it's on the street in those police encounters, whether it's car stops, or even the way that the NYPD, you know, uses its gang database or identifies people who are associated with gangs. So, you know, one person that I spoke with today, actually the lead counsel on that Floyd case, Darius Charney from the Center for Constitutional Rights, say stop and frisk is just really one chapter in this long history of policing and race in policing. In New York City.
The conversation continues. WNYC's Yasmin Khan, a reporter covering police in the WNYC newsroom. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you so much, Jamie.
Got up this morning, things weren't working right. I said I want to make a change. I said I want to fight. Obama walked up and said, yes, we can. I said I want to ride your nuts because I think you're the man. Now I'm sick right in. Obama, Obama.
Tonight, 10 Democrats will be in Atlanta for the next presidential debate. Looming over them in some ways is Barack Obama, who recently gave some unsolicited advice about the future direction of the Democratic Party. Now, Obama is extremely popular among Democratic voters, but in the middle of the 2020 campaign, his legacy is mixed. NPR's Juana Summers has the story.
Democrats meet at this Mexican restaurant in Kansas City, Kansas, for breakfast every month. On this particular Saturday, as they pile their plates high with eggs, grilled vegetables, and foil-wrapped tortillas, they settle in to hear from a candidate hoping to turn one of the state's U.S. Senate seats blue. They're also sorting through who they plan to support in the Democratic presidential race. Organizers handed out yellow ruled index cards.
Who are you picking right this minute as your favorite?
You can put Democratic nominee, all of the above.
That voter is Melissa Bynum. She's 56 and an at-large commissioner here in Wyandotte County, Kansas. She didn't tell me who she wrote down on her index card, but she says she wants to hear candidates paint a big picture vision for the future. She's full of praise for the last successful Democratic presidential nominee, and Bynum wants the 2020 candidates to recognize Barack Obama's legacy.
Well, I think that they need to make sure that they are acknowledging all of the good that he was able to accomplish in his 8 years in the White House.
She specifically mentions the Affordable Care Act, one of Obama's signature accomplishments. A couple tables over from Bynum is Paul Avila. He says he hasn't made up his mind yet, but he's leaning toward candidates like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, drawn to their calls for large-scale change.
They're much more progressive, willing to take more chances in order to win.
Here's what he has to say when I ask him about President Obama.
He was a good president, but there were some things about his presidency that left a lot to be desired.
Obama isn't on the ballot in 2020, but Democrats on the campaign trail and at local party meetings like this one are grappling with his legacy.
On the debate stage, those clashes have come over whether to stick with or scrap his signature health care law in favor of a single-payer system. Democratic candidates have also tussled over his record on immigration. While Obama has privately talked with a number of Democrats seeking the White House, he's mostly kept a low profile. That changed last week. Obama was speaking at a liberal donor gathering in Washington. He urged fellow Democrats to remember the long, messy primary slog he endured in his 2008 campaign against Hillary Clinton, saying it ultimately made him a better candidate. But Obama also made a big statement. It was recorded off mic. He started off saying voters are interested in things being improved.
But the average American doesn't think that we have to completely tear down the system and remake it.
He was warning Democrats against tearing down the system. So why is Obama saying this now? I asked Joel Payne that question. He's a Democratic strategist who worked for Harry Reid and Hillary Clinton.
On one level, it was an implicit defense of the Obama years and of the value of all of the advances and the progress that he helped make under his presidency. I also thought it was a bit of a warning to the party to not lurch too far in this instance to the left.
He also said that while Democratic voters admire Obama, the optimistic, positive case he made in 2007 and 2008 may not play as well today.
Barack Obama right now is probably not in tune. He and the way he governed and the way he campaigned is not in tune with today's Democratic Party.
Florentino Camacho made that point at the Kansas breakfast I attended. He's in his 70s and said that Obama was one of the best presidents of his lifetime. But things have changed. And he had some advice for Democrats hoping to beat President Trump in a general election.
I think they're doing good, but they have to start fighting as bad and as dirty as the Republicans.
But some voters miss the optimism of the Obama years. Ariel Monroe is one of them. Obama won the White House for the first time when she was just starting college.
All different kinds of people related to this man, how we all believed in him. There was this whole message of hope, right? And that it'll all get better for people who have grown up, maybe not feeling that that's a possibility.
Monroe hasn't found a candidate that inspiring.
I'm not excited right now, but I hope to be soon.
It's been more than a decade since Obama was first elected. The Democratic Party has moved to the left, raising the question of whether there is one candidate who can inspire the same broad coalition of voters that Obama did, or if that's what Democrats need to win next year. Juana Summers, NPR News.
This question, why is this stuff happening? The New York Times editorial today. The Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 12/10/2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. See, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
The author Clifford Thompson has spent a lot of time thinking about identity.
As a young man, I kind of struggled with how do you as a black person kind of fit yourself into American society? For most of us, America is the only home we've ever known. On the other hand, America has such a history of oppression of people of color. So where do you fit yourself into that picture?
He often thinks about his place in America, and he says for him, the 2016 election brought on a new period of reflection. He did not vote for President Trump. Actually, he rarely meets people who did. Maybe you can relate to Thompson, maybe not, but no doubt this is a divisive time in our country, a time when many people with views for or against this president have trouble understanding the other side.
There are a lot of stories of liberals, going to a Thanksgiving dinner and their uncle is there who's a Trump supporter and, you know, they either have an argument or they avoid the subject of politics altogether. As a black person, you know, my circle tends not to include a lot of conservative Republicans. So it's not that I think Trump supporters are space aliens or anything like that. It's just that in the normal course of things, I tend not to have lengthy conversations with them. So I decided that maybe it was time to. Maybe it was time to do that.
And that is exactly what he did. To understand his country and himself, he sought out people who support President Trump. Now, to be clear, he wasn't trying for a representative sample of Trump voters. He only wrote about several of them, all of them white men. He also wasn't trying to draw any sweeping conclusion about our country. This was a very personal journey that he writes about in his new book, What It Is.
So when Donald Trump was elected, it came out that the majority of white voters in the country supported him. So if you are a black person who has always kind of founded your beliefs on the notion that you should not be prejudiced, that you should not judge people according to skin color, but the majority of whites in the country have supported a man who received the endorsement of the Ku Klux Klan, where does that leave you? And so for the first time in my life, I felt the sort of foundational personal beliefs of mine to be challenged in a major way. And so it became a matter of figuring out how to go forward with this challenge.
And you decided as part of going forward that you wanted to meet and listen to some voters who supported Donald Trump. How did you reach that decision?
I wanted to talk to Trump supporters just to try to get a sense of what exactly some of – I mean, I certainly can't talk to all Trump supporters, and there's some I don't want to talk to, but I wanted to get a sense of what some of them were thinking so that I could then come to some sort of rational conclusion about why so many people supported this man.
Well, and some of your conversations that you write about in the book, I mean, they were captivating. And we should say, I think you gave them different names to protect their identities,
yes,
right?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm.
So there was a guy you called Bob, who you
yes.
spent some time with.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about him so our listeners know.
Sure. Bob is a Californian. He's white. He's in his 70s. He's a retired California highway patrolman. And so he welcomed me into his home. We started talking about his upbringing, his career. And I asked him questions about race. And almost out of the blue at one point, he remembered an experience he had in the early 1970s when he was a patrolman. And he said, you know, this isn't nice. Do you want to hear it? And I said, yes, I do. So he proceeded to tell me what it was.
So Bob is sitting there and recounts a time that he used the N-word and he tells
right.
you about this.
Right.
Well, I mean, how did you react to that?
I admired him for sharing that story with me because he certainly didn't have to, and he knew that it would not make him look good. So he understands that this was not a good thing to have done. And he very much identifies himself as somebody who is not racist, who does not make judgments on the basis of race. At the same time, as became clear in our conversation, as became clear to me, he would say things that indicated to me, if not to him, sort of negative attitudes toward black people. So, you know, on the one hand, he identifies as somebody who is not racist. On the other hand, I think he has beliefs that I don't even think that he's aware of having, which are negative about people of color.
I guess it's important to point out, I mean, obviously these were just a couple conversations, and I, my colleagues and I have interviewed a lot of people who supported President Trump who might have had similarities to these guys or might not. I want to focus more on you and what did you get out of this and these conversations?
One notion I came away with is that and this sort of transcends the time that we're in and transcends Trump's election and everything, is that I think most people are decent. A lot of people are not. But even at a level below that, people are selfish and they tend to do things in support of their interests or what they think their interests are. And that's how people have to be. And so when it comes to Trump's election, I think people vote for him for a variety of reasons. You know, maybe you voted for him because you think he's going to bring back coal mining jobs. And the flip side of that is a certain indifference to the concerns of other people. And I think indifference is – I think it can't be underestimated as a factor in what's going on now.
Do you feel like you've changed going through this project?
I still maintain my beliefs in, one, you know, calling myself an American, and two, judging people if I have to judge them as individuals. What's changed, I think, is my sympathy for people of color who just can't get there. But I choose to maintain this rootedness that I have in not being prejudiced and in identifying as an American.
Clifford Thompson, a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Clifford Thompson, his new book is called What It Is.
Georgia.
10 Democratic presidential hopefuls take the debate stage in Atlanta tonight. They'll do so at the largest black-owned film studio in the country. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Stephen Fowler explains what the location says about the 2020 vote.
The sound stages at Tyler Perry Studios have been home to Wakanda, The White House, and The Walking Dead. Acclaimed filmmaker and producer Tyler Perry bought the expansive property near the airport in 2015. Thanks to the success of his Madea movie series and other projects, Tyler Perry is the only black owner of a major film studio and has the largest production studio in the country. Just how big is it?
330 acres and 12 sound stages, and I dedicated them all this weekend to people that have paved the way, that have motivated and inspired me.
That's Perry speaking last month to Jimmy Kimmel after the studio's official grand opening. When you drive past the outside of Tyler Perry Studios, it kind of reminds you of a fortress. That's because it was. From 1885 to 2011, Fort McPherson served as a U.S. Army base until its closure, which left a void in the community. But now, the film industry is taking off in Metro Atlanta, and the region's economy and politics are shifting along with it. Kalina Bowler says she's not surprised the growth has attracted a high-profile presidential debate.
They're saying, look, pay attention to the South. Pay attention to Georgia. Pay attention to these so-called flyover states that you used to think were just pushed to the side.
Bowler is a recently retired location manager who spent 15 years scouting out Atlanta locations to film movies, music videos, and TV commercials. The film industry has taken an increasingly prominent role in politics here. Earlier this year, several Hollywood actors and production companies called for a boycott of the state after its Republican governor signed a bill tightening restrictions on abortion. But Perry made headlines when he said he couldn't just up and leave the place he called home. Last year's tight gubernatorial election in Georgia showed that Democrats have an opening in a fast-growing state. Bowler says that has to include voices like Perry's.
You cannot look away from the black Democratic vote. You cannot discredit and you cannot ignore how much of a contribution we're making to the country as a whole.
The debate is being held in a predominantly black neighborhood, in a predominantly black city, at a black-owned venue with the support of a black female mayor and state party chair. Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms lobbied the Democratic National Committee to bring the debate to the city.
Atlanta is really this crown jewel of the South in so many ways. The diversity that it reflects, our economy in the metro area.
She said it was a no-brainer to bring presidential candidates here in what's shaping up to be a huge political year in the state.
There is this opportunity before Democrats in Georgia that we've not seen and likely won't see again for many years. And that's the opportunity to elect two senators as well as cast a vote for a presidential candidate.
The debate is not the only big ticket item coming to the studios in this corner of the city. Several movies are actively filming there, and the Miss Universe pageant, once owned by President Trump, is coming in December. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Fowler in Atlanta.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
A possible church massacre prevented.
Tonight, we're learning new information about the plot and hearing from some church members who are stunned.
I just think it was like of the devil.
Live, local, late-breaking. This is the Channel 2 Action News Nightbeat. Coverage you can count on.
Good evening. I'm Justin Farmer.
I'm Jovita Moore. Here's what we know so far about this alleged plan. The suspect is a 16-year-old girl. Investigators are not identifying her because they are charging her as a juvenile. Police say she idolized Dylan Roof. You may remember he is the South Carolina teenager who was charged with the 2015 massacre at a church in Charleston. Investigators say they found several knives and a notebook with detailed plans to kill people. Channel 2's Christian Jennings is live at Bethel AME Church. That's in Gainesville. And worshipers are thanking God that nothing happened there. Christian?
Jovita, so incredibly scary. And police say that this girl wanted to kill the members of this church because of their race. So she showed up here on a Wednesday night earlier this month. Wednesday is typically Bible study night. She had knives with her at the time, police say. Thankfully, services were canceled that night here, and the pastor calls that divine intervention.
It's scary. Well, what could have possibly happened?
Shauna Ramsey is a trustee at Bethel AME Church in Gainesville. Police say a white 16-year-old girl made detailed plans to carry out a racially motivated attack here. The small church of only about 40 members is predominantly black.
It's just very disturbing.
I just think it was like of the devil.
Police say thanks to a student at Gainesville High School speaking up, they were able to prevent a potential church massacre.
Luckily, she mentioned this to another student, and the student found it alarming.
Investigators say earlier this month, the teen went to this church to carry out her mission, but church services just happened to be canceled.
She went to great lengths to plan it, to get weapons, and launch our attack on the church.
It ought to bother us that in the state of Georgia, this young girl, this young woman cannot be charged with a hate crime.
That's because Georgia is one of just four states that doesn't have hate crime legislation. State Representative Chuck Evstration hopes to change that in 2020 with a bill that would allow enhanced sentencing for people who commit hate crimes.
If a person is targeted because of their race or religion, law enforcement should be able to recognize and prosecute that person for the attack on all of society that these crimes reflect.
I spoke on the phone with the reverend of this church a little over an hour ago. She told me that tomorrow night she'll be holding a big meeting so that they can discuss ways to increase security here. Very important. And we also know that police are continuing to investigate. This investigation far from over, but the church members say they are praying for this girl, but they want her charged as an adult. Reporting live in Hall County, Christian Jennings, Channel 2 Action News Nightbeat.
White girls do it better. Context of white supremacy, Gusty Renegade, and for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, November 23, 2019. So I have been told this is our weekly compensatory call-in, strictly for listeners, attempted counter-racists to dial in with their thoughts, views, observations from the past 7 days. Certainly, if you are in the state of Georgia, really anywhere, but certainly we have listeners live in Atlanta. Gus T, former Atlanta resident. No way that sort of event can happen and you can be ignorant about that one. That one definitely goes in the files. Folks talking about the holidays. Oh my goodness, the timing. If I'm in Georgia, I have family members who have fussed at me. Oh, man. Talking about racism. Complaining about that. They will get rolling. Man, had that event happen and we sit down to carve up the old turkey. Giblets. Thanksgiving dinner. And think that I'm not going to mention that. Man, did you all see what happened? She went to stab up the church. Had a meeting about security. 16 years old, said she was inspired by Dylan Storm Roof. Pass the cranberry sauce. Think that would not get brought up at the dinner table at the holiday festivities if we lived in Georgia. Maybe if we lived anywhere, but certainly if we lived in Georgia, that's going to be brought up. And it's going to be brought up in the context of, can you believe that happened in the same state where they had the Democratic presidential debate? Oh, no such thing as a coincidence. The number is 605-313-5164. Be code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Many things to report. There were a lot of news segments I did not even include. There were so many things that took place this week. Wow. So many mentions of President Obama this week. I neglected to include my Damn You Obama sound clip. I feel like I used to get to play that every weekend, and now he's not here. And woo, President Obama. Let's see. They had the segment where they talked about President Obama and missing his optimism and his legacy, whatever that means, looming over this election and the Democratic primary. That's another metaphor there. They said that President Obama made us feel like President Obama was someone we all related to with hope and optimism. That is just not accurate. You can have hyperbole, you can exaggerate a little bit, but that is not true. Historic numbers of death threats. How did we get to President Trump? All of the children on the bus, I remember they had one in Oregon where they were threatening assassinations, targeting Michelle Obama, first lady, calling her a gorilla. I remember it was 8 years of all of that. The Tea Party, the town hall meetings where whites were walking around with firearms saying, we're going to take our country back. We're mad. That was President now Trump. How he got here? Again, you're not even a citizen. How did you get to be president? I don't think we're all related. And more importantly, one of our listeners used to point out on a pretty regular basis that most white people did not vote for President Obama in 2008 or in 2012. Now, yes, you did have whites vote for him, but you had substantially less than 50% of the white voters support him in either election, which is important. I think what that means is that more white people voted for President Trump in 2016 than voted for President Obama in 2012 or 2008. I'd have to go back to look at the numbers to be exact, but I know I looked at the numbers. President Obama never got the majority of white voters. President Trump did. Moving forward, I posted today, I am a Neanderthal, not had a phone. That's how I felt. I will not use a metaphor, but I feel like a Neanderthal not having had a phone for so long and easy ability to take photographs. As I was out and about today doing yoga, getting groceries, I saw a Seattle City worker. She had on a yellow safety vest, a neon safety vest, and it had emblazoned on the back of the vest the face of Dr. King and then the writing King County. And I whipped out my phone like I've had it for 10 years, and whammo, took a picture. I posted it online so that folks can see that I have not been lying, making this up. Literally, once you get to Seattle, you will see Dr. King's face everywhere. And I've said for years, I'm not born in this area, but I said I'm not even sure if Dr. King ever came here. Like, I don't hear anyone talk like, oh, yeah, he gave that speech around, such and such, or he was at the Space Needle, or anything. Like, I just don't hear people talk about him giving a specific talk or something. So I shared the image today. Say, see, you'll see his image everywhere. Tacky, triple T's. And someone said, well, wait a minute, Dr. King was there. And I said, whoa, really? And they didn't post the link. They didn't post any information. They just said he was there. So I went to search online. And even that, I have looked before. I have researched why, when, how did King County come to be named that way? Slave owner, 19th century, all of that. I've seen that information repeatedly in the Seattle Times and many other outlets. I've never heard any information within all of that. It includes, oh yeah, by the way, Dr. King did make one trip to Seattle in November of 1961. I found that on historylink.org. It says that he came here. He spoke at Garfield High School. We heard about them last week, and he gave a talk at a church. Interestingly, and I put this in context now, Seattle is in King County. Made the name change in 1980s. It became official in 2006, I believe. Racism at First Presbyterian. Arrangements were made for Dr. King to speak at First Presbyterian Church because Mount Zion would not be large enough to handle the numbers expected. First Presbyterian Church canceled the oral agreement to rent the sanctuary to Mount Zion just weeks before Dr. King's scheduled arrival and shortly after advertisements of his lecture were circulated. The reasons ranged from construction work to other commitments, but Mr. McKinney attributed to racism. Samuel B. McKinney, black male victim of racism. He appealed to First Presbyterian Church leaders, but this only produced other excuses, such as the use of the sanctuary only for religious meetings, Dr. King is a no-count heathen, and the reluctance to have proceeds go not to Mount Zion's building fund, but to King's enterprise. Local organizations and churches denounced the cancellation. The Christian Friends for Racial Equality, Grace Methodist Church, the Baptist Ministers Conference of Seattle and Vicinity, and the Capitol Hill Ministerial Association voiced shock and disapproval. Even the Presbytery of Seattle commended King to its member churches. And they go on to talk about how they had to compensate and get a different location. But I mean, if that type of tackiness is attached to his one visit to Seattle, he didn't live here. He didn't have a summer house here or a Mary. It's not like Coretta Scott King was from Seattle. Why would you have the county named after he came here one time and we had the religion of white supremacy? He came here one time and whites reneged. Oh, you can perform at our church. Oh, wait a minute. We got construction. We had the pews are not working correctly. Wait a minute, the parking lot is in decay. We had apples fall on the front steps. Wait a minute, I don't think we're going to be able to get you in here, Dr. King. I'm so sorry. You got the flyers out? Oh, man. Oh, I'm heartbroken. So is the shame. Yeah, we got, oh, you said the roof fell in too. Yeah, see, the roof fell in. And an orange tree, yep. The orange tree out front, we got to get that cut down too. And yeah, it's tough luck. It's tough luck, man. I'm sorry, Dr. King. But we will name the county after you about 20, 30 years after you're dead. Your face will be everywhere in the city of Seattle. We don't have too many Negros in this city, but we will have Dr. King's face everywhere. Next. When they played the segment and I got confused because there were so many this week, they had the report at Syracuse. I almost went to Syracuse. I remembered when they had that segment about all the racist incidents, talk about confusion. It was so many. I remember they called my house. I think they called within 24 hours of getting the letter like, oh, you made it. You go to Syracuse. And that wasn't one of my top choices. It's like, oh, okay. I did visit the school. They have a nice campus, fun visit, maybe. They made it sound so pleasant, like, wow, Carmelo Anthony, all that, like, man, go to Syracuse, yeah. And not that it would have been any different anywhere else. University of Virginia, the Coon Man, what's the difference? But they had so many incidents, the situation in Oregon, and I just mentioned Syracuse, when they had the situation and they were talking to the young fellas who sounded like a young white student, they didn't have video. And he said, well, you know, they made it kind of a joke. You had somebody for a decade who has been talking about racist jokes. That is one of the ways that the culture of white supremacy is transmitted those racist jokes, talked about that for a decade here. And he said, you know, well, you know, I'll hear new iterations of the N-word. Or I'll hear something like, man, it sure would be fun to get the car and run over a bunch of black people. Now, I inserted the laugh track there. That has happened before. I put the laughter there. That was not in the actual clip. But I do think that that's important because that is so consistent. Racist jokes consistently are focused on black people, which is what he said. And the punchline will be about violence to black people. We've had people who call in and said that a white person told a racist joke on their job. And it's, what do you call four black people in a car going off a cliff? It was like a good start. And it was confusing. Even, you know, what does that even mean? Why would you say something like violence against black people? That's what so many of the jokes are. Well, I got one from the Obama days. It was, what do President Obama and an apple have in common? They both look good hanging from a tree. See, the violence against black people is funny. That's what he said. Violence against black people is funny. It's something that should be enjoyed and joked about. Same way we talked about with the Moores Ford Bridge lynching. Yes, we're all going to come out and have a grand old time and take a picture and tell jokes. This is great. Cut off the nigger's penis. This is supposed to be fun. Whites enjoy practicing racism. They're not ignorant about racism. They enjoy it. You heard it from the mouth of babes. Isn't that what they say? That's what he said. But I just want to make sure there's no confusion. I did add the laugh track there for all of that. Mentioned the Syracuse. When they talked about New York, I mentioned some of that on workplace racism because they included workplace racism in the Newsday investigation, black people not getting calls for interviews and white people having a better network and all of that. They talked about that too, as well as the housing. And then they talked about former mayor Michael Bloomberg, his apology. Sorry that I rousted, you know, Thomason, I'm sorry. We rousted you, snatched you down. Khalif Browder, I'm so sorry. My fault. Eric Garner, I'm so sorry. My fault. Didn't mean to do that. Hope you all haven't had too tough a time here in New York City. My fault. It reminded me, reading is more important than watching television. We just read the late Toni Morrison's Tar Baby. She talked about New York City and she described it as a black woman's town. I don't know the correct word to describe my response when reading, hearing that the first time, stunned, but that maybe is not intense enough. If anyone is confused about racism, it is black people, victims of racism, white supremacy. But I heard all of that. I thought New York was a black woman's town. That's what Toni Morrison said. How could all of this be in a black woman's town? Michael Bloomberg shouldn't have to go out in the pot. This is a black woman's town. Victim of racism, VGQ, Toni Morrison. We did read that, though. Man, oh man, reading more important than watching television. So Clifford Thompson, the black male who wrote the book, What It Is, where he went and interviewed these white males who voted for Trump. Number one, in 2016, most white women voters supported Donald Trump. I don't know why someone would focus on Donald Trump and his tenure in the White House and totally exclude white women. They had a huge role in his ascendancy to power. 52% of white women voters in 2016 went with Mr. Trump. But that notwithstanding, Mr. Thompson, black male, he wrote this here book talking to white male voters, trying to figure out why they supported President Trump. He said in that audio segment that one thing that changed was his sympathy for black people who just don't get it, presumably it being racism, white supremacy. And I wasn't sure what he meant, if that meant that he had less sympathy for black people who are confused about racism, if that meant he had more sympathy. I was a little bit confused about that. And it was right at the interview and they didn't really follow up. He said that he emphasized, I think, a few times that after this, that he is not prejudiced. And I don't even know. I don't use the word prejudice as a synonym for racism, white supremacy, and certainly it's not. Confusion is lethal. If anyone is ignorant about racism, white supremacy, it's black people. But he said he was not prejudiced, and doing this work and writing this book, he's still not prejudiced. And I don't know what that means either. VGQ. And he said he still thinks of himself as an American. I don't know what that means. And I know that word is in the word guide and is recommended that we not use that term, or we use that term to mean someone who practices justice. But all I can say is confusion is lethal. And I have reached out to Mr. Thompson to see if we can have him as a guest on the program just because I have questions, lots and lots and lots of questions. So hopefully we'll be able to have him on the broadcast, even though I am certainly much more excited about having white people on the broadcast. With that, I'll save the rest of my man. 16-year-old white girl in Georgia plotted a terrorist attack and idolized Dylan Storm Roof. She had a manifesto. That's what the enforcement officials reported. She had a manifesto. And just like Dylan Storm Roof, she had done her recon. She had visited the church. I don't know if that was she had planned to commit her attack right then, or if that was just to do research to see how many people she'd have a chance to kill, what type of security they would have. I think it's important that the black members at the Gainesville Bethel AME Church, I didn't hear in that report forgiveness. I heard frustration that they don't have hate crime laws, so-called, in Georgia, and also frustration that this teenage white female, frustration that she is not being charged as an adult. That sounds like black self-respect. Thinking logically, I didn't hear crying and all the rest of it that we heard with Dylan Storm Roof, where people got upset at the victims. I heard people thinking logically. And meetings, I saw that as well. Meetings about increased safety to prevent this sort of thing from happening. Sounds like they are using counter-racist logic. With that, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio invest. If you think the program is constructive, you can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, Cash App is also functioning. I did not have a phone until a few days ago. I had signed up for Cash App. Listener said you should use that. People would probably invest that way. Not having a phone, you can't activate the account. Investors support it, and the funds ended up being expired, terminated, because my account wasn't activated until a few days ago because I didn't have a phone. Anywho, Cash App is functioning now for folks who do use that. It is linked in the description, the address cash.app/$thecows. Much obliged to all the investors who have supported. I hope the cows has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. If you are not into all of that newfangled technology, drop an email and we can get you a physical mailing address. Again, much obliged to all of the folks who have supported. You can also nab items from my wish list. It is at Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade. Huge gratitude to all of the listeners who have nabbed items over the past decade plus. I hope the cows has provided accurate information about what white supremacy racism is, what it means to be classified as white, and what non-white people can and should be doing to solve this problem as soon as possible. With that, the number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-9435. 3 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. We will hit the phone lines. If you could take, oh my goodness, how could I forget? This is our compensatory call-in. This is the one time where I request if we could not use metaphors. There were quite a few metaphors, dark period, that's when they use on a regular basis. If we could not use metaphors during this broadcast, racists, they frequently use metaphors to transmit ideas of white supremacy racism. They also will use metaphors, analogies, similes to practice deception. They'll often take two concepts and insist that they are equivalent, identical. Frequently, this is not the case at all. This is master deception, racism, white supremacy. Victims, including Gus T., we have been exposed to this misconduct for centuries. It has had an impact. And many of us, we are still learning. As such, sometimes we don't have logic to articulate our thoughts on a particular topic, which is fine. But we'll substitute a simile or metaphor of some sort, and that just adds to confusion frequently. If we could be explicit, exact, precise about what we want to say this evening, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Thank you kindly. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, that would be grand. Just make sure everybody gets at least one opportunity to speak. If you have additional questions or comments, just make sure everyone has spoken once and then you can share again. I will again, this is not a broadcast for spectators. And I will also ask if we could not wait until the last 3 minutes, 5 minutes to share. I think it was 2 weeks ago. We got about 8 minutes left in the program and we had a chorus. I think it was about five or six people all at the same time. Once we had about 8 minutes until we wrapped up. Oh, wait a minute, Gus. I just got about five things. I just got about six quick things. I just got about eight quick things just to get in. Just nine quick things. Here we go. Okay. 10 quick things. If you could go ahead and get your hand up, that would be grand. If we could not wait until the very end and then decide, oh yeah, I don't want to spectate. I do think I actually have a few things to share. That would be spectacular. Super appreciated. Star 61, if you have a thought, comment, question you would like to share. If we have folks in Georgia, man, I hope you are on your counter racist duty. I would make sure I had lots to share. I would have all of the latest information about this little 16-year-old white female, and emphasis on that every time, white female race soldier, and her plans to attack a black church. Context of white supremacy. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, all the callers today. Thank you very much for allowing me the space. First, you know, since we're calling in for this week, I did try the recipe with the cornbread. My wife liked it. It took a little longer to cook than regular, but after we browned it some more, it was really good, so we appreciate that.
Love it.
But let's get to what we heard today. The British monarchy links to Jeffrey Epstein. That's really serious, especially since he has links to monarchies, presidents, all of these places, and then now they try the security guards who were supposed to be watching them for crimes, when it's government people in high places that have links to him that specifically targeted, that suspected. the person who called in and said that he went to interview the Trump supporters, the black male, non-white male, what it looked like to me, what it reminds me of is that other black man who goes and meet with the Ku Klux Klan and they give him his robes, give them their Klan robes, and he keeps them in a weird collection, and he goes to their rallies. I found that very interesting and disturbing. Let me see. What else? Also, you talked about former President Barack Obama and people feeling as if they missed his time there and as president. He labeled himself as a moderate. And most of the time when he comes out to speak, it's to pretty much quell any black rebellion or to further confuse and guide people. He does not come out to speak when black people are talking about reparations and masks. He's not coming out to speak when it comes to civil rights cases being argued in the Supreme Court that affects us via corporate racism. He's coming out to say that, hey, we must support the system. So if this isn't evidence more of why certain non-white black people feel a certain way, then I don't know what else to say concerning that. Tyler Perry's land acquisition in Georgia, I feel, is great, but we cannot ignore this is a large-scale example of white flight. And also, the reason for that flight was not necessarily, black people, but it's also business in regards to abortion. And at this time, they made it look as if they wanted what they said go. Everybody's going to jump on the bandwagon, and we're going to boycott Georgia, as if everyone would follow. Tyler Perry did not. And since he did not follow, apparently, he was able to acquire a large sum of land and acquire a lot of financial resources to keep people in that state and to be the scapegoat to say that, hey, we tried. Now, here, look at this thing. So I don't know if it was used just to be a distraction as well, but I'm trying to become less confused with that. Also, you mentioned the confirmed white supremacist female child and the hate crime law. It's funny how they can say that there is no. It's not funny. Correction. I don't understand completely how they can say that there is no hate crime law, and that's why she's been, sentenced as a child. However, the government will charge you for a federal crime of terrorism because that's what she was. She was a terrorist who went into a church in order to murder and strike fear in
30 seconds.
Black people. All right, that's it. Have a good one. Thanks. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged. You can say a lot in 30 seconds. That's just general for listeners. You can say a lot. You'd be surprised. Jump on the bandwagon, scapegoat. Those are metaphors. I think even white flight. Yeah, that's a metaphor too, white flight, because they're not, they don't have like feathers and wings. And I think it could be a metaphor at minimum. I'm not sure what you mean when you say that President Obama, he speaks to quell black rebellion. Like, I don't even know what that means. I've heard President Obama speak many times over the years about a number of things, but I've never heard him speak where I thought, oh yes, President Obama is speaking today to quell black rebellion. Again, I don't even know what that means. If we'll pause, or I won't pause. If you can hang tight, let me nab some of the other folks who called in. Once we get them, perhaps you can explain what that phrase even means. Black quell, black rebellion, and maybe even cite an example of a time when this happened. Let's see, other folks who dialed in that we have missed totally. If you have a hand up, questions, comments, proceed.
Hi, Gus.
Be in Toronto.
Hi, greetings to you, callers and listeners. I came in late, so unfortunately I didn't get a chance to hear the newsreel at the beginning. However, once it's uploaded, then I would be able to review. But I do have some observations that I've noticed while interacting with white people. In addition to observations I've noticed while looking at some documentaries regarding the Jim Jones mass suicide that some news outlets claim, and in others, according to the witnesses themselves, also would classify as a mixture of mass suicide and mass murder. So in terms of interactions with white people for the past 2 weeks, I've just been noticing, and I hadn't really noticed how frequently they've done this before, but I've noticed how they are particularly adept at trying to get people, in particular non-whites, agitated or heightened with lack of information. So, for example, there is a couple of people that I'm working with. And I noticed that they tend to be very dramatic. If it's a missing pencil or a missing pen, they tend to turn that into a detective mystery of sorts. I'm trying to avoid using metaphors. So let me try and view it, or try and state it the best way I can. So they'll take a certain situation, not give the information, so omission of information, and try to make a situation bigger than it is, and then try to use non-white people as tools to solve the mess that they've created. And I've been more and more catching myself in stopping myself from actually wanting to solve the situation. For myself, I'm especially on the job, I'm an avid problem solver. However, I'm also now taking myself out of the equation, encouraging those that I work with to solve their own problems so that I'm not involved, and so I don't receive any backlash should there be any backlash. So I've been actively doing that, and I find it extremely beneficial. I would encourage non-whites in general. I know that it's been mentioned before that for whites, they definitely do not need any help. They have lots of help. And to redirect that help more to those who need it the most. Unfortunately, I don't have a choice as to whom I would be able to redirect it professionally, but personally, through volunteering, I'm able to redirect a lot of my resources to who would need it the most. So I do it that way. But at the same time, I would urge non-whites to, whenever whites are telling their stories and they seem to have a very heightened, agitated dramatic flair to it, to step back and listen, and then urge them to solve their own problem, so that you are not used as a tool and then a recipient of backlash as a result. Luckily, I have not been a recipient of any backlash by utilizing that, and I've used it as my personal code. Now, in terms of the Jim Jones documentaries, I noticed that it was quite interesting that the reporters would focus mainly on the white defectors of Jim Jones, but they didn't focus as much on the black defectors from the commune in Guyana. What was interesting is that the $500,000 was left in the hands of three white men at the end of the mass suicide / murder. Over at the airplane, the majority of defectors were white going into the airplane. However, the six black defectors who were able to go, who were able to go into the jungle, they were met with guns by the Guyana police once they showed up trying to look for help. So I find it's very interesting to look into the Jim Jones, and that's what I've been doing, and that's what I've been finding, that it was interesting how whites were able to get information to leave, whereas the majority of non-whites died. Thank you, and I leave the line.
Sounds like some unjust networking there. That anniversary was this week as well. Yesterday was the 66-year anniversary 66 years since President Kennedy was assassinated, but it was also the anniversary of the Jonestown Massacre from November 18th, of this past Monday. But yeah, I'm certain there were a lot of projects. We will be doing a program on that coming up shortly. Super important. We talked about that quite a bit last week, so I'm sure some other folks will be curious to hear what documentaries or research you found. Be in Toronto. Again, no surprise, whites got critical information, life-saving information that seemed to be withheld from black people. Other folks who dialed in that we have missed totally, if you have comments, questions, observations to share, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Ohio.
Hello, everyone. Hello. Thank you for taking my call. First thing I did want to mention, just saying something about what Bea in Toronto said. I've watched quite a few documentaries on Jonestown, and they primarily focus on just the white people from the People's Temple. So you'll definitely see that pattern. I've watched them on, I think they had like a series of, I can't remember what it was exactly called, but it was basically about like evil religious leaders. And he had an episode on there. They also had like, I think maybe on the History Channel, something on Netflix. So there's a lot of different documentaries on him. And in most of the documentaries, he is this wonderful person. I remember one documentary, they even tried to say that he was instrumental in desegregating, I think it was Illinois or Indiana, whatever northern state that he started out in, which I thought was a really interesting way of practicing racism. The other thing that I also picked up on, just like Gus picked up on, was the commentary from the churchgoers in Georgia about the white terrorist, the white female terrorist, and how she was being charged as a juvenile. And I don't think that any of her actions proved to be juvenile in her mind state or anything. If she planned this out, if she, you know, she, like you said, she did the recon, I don't understand why then would she be charged as a juvenile. There are so many other people who commit heinous acts and, you know, with less planning, and they're not charged as juveniles. So I thought that that was interesting, but it was also, I did appreciate how the church board said that they, you know, there was no crime, like you said, and how she should be charged as an adult. Also thought that it was interesting how Georgia didn't have a hate crime statute, which I guess I thought that that was, you know, hate crimes. I thought that that was actually something that all states would have, but I guess that's what they call it, like a vestige from maybe slavery or Jim Crow. So that's the only way that I could kind of even understand it. And I feel like there was a Cal show with Dr. Welsing, and I think about that sometimes when it comes to victims of racism forgiving racists. And she said something about you don't necessarily have to forgive. That's like a sign of confusion or mental illness or something of that nature. And definitely correct me, because I know that I'm messing that up, but it was basically like you don't necessarily have to forgive, like, you know, someone who is doing something to you. You don't have to let it affect you in a negative way to where you cannot function on a daily basis. But you don't just have to forgive as far as, you know, at least for what I was taught from a religious standpoint. The last thing I'll mention is that I didn't realize that in Ohio there's also an affordable housing crisis. And when I was watching the news recently, there's supposed to be, I think it was the governor, or I'm not sure, some white official, and they were speaking about how they're going to allocate so much money towards different areas, and it was in the billions of dollars, and they did say only about $1 billion or $2 billion would be allocated towards towards reducing the housing crisis, the affordable housing crisis, but there was going to be about over $10 million allocated towards $10 million or $1 billion allocated towards law enforcement officials. So I thought that that was interesting. So people can't find housing, but you do need more police. So that's the way to correct the problem. I'll mute my line. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Gonna have all these folks out panhandling and sleeping on park benches, then yeah, gotta have more enforcement officials. Have folks out hassling me every 5 seconds for a quarter, and got some spare change and such. Yeah, that's following logic. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I do want to say quickly, I do feel pretty well hearing that some of the listeners are trying some of the hopefully healthier, better eating options, eating more fruits, vegetables. If you're going to do baking and things, you can find substitutes for dairy, egg, less sugar, substitutes for sugar. Man, the cookies that I was bragging about having gotten from Walmart, they were vegan and sugarless. I wasn't even aware, because I've had these cookies. I've been eating these cookies for a while. They are sugarless. You can still have great treats. Just make, you know, a few adjustments. But I'm very happy to hear that some folks tried
the cornbread, and that's not even like my signature cornbread is the vegan sweet potato cornbread, which I may make this week. I just did a regular version, but just making substitutes, but delish. Hopeful to hear other folks and just cooking in general, because I do think that's important. I think we should try as much as we can to eliminate white people having their hands and paws all over our food. I've said that for a long time. Let's minimize opportunities for racists to put things in our mouth. I think that is much healthier, where more often you are the ones, your hands are the ones that prepared the food that you're going to eat. Like, take that really serious, things that you eat. That is critical. I think racists, they do a good job of desensitizing us to words and desensitizing us to what we eat, among many other things, and the impact what you say has on how you think, how you behave, the impact what you eat has on how you feel, what you say, how you think. So be mindful, do more cooking. Glad to hear that as well. Do a little bit more cooking. Man, been saying that for a long time. Eat out less. That is counter-racism right there. 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate.
Andy Hook.
Greetings, Henry, in Chicago.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. We had a incident here in Chicago, in Naperville. Apparently a 14-year-old white boy took a picture of his 14-year-old classmate, posted an advertisement on Craigslist saying black slave boy for sale. And it was an incident that's been reported here in Chicago. The authorities investigated, found the white boy who was responsible, and charged him with a hate crime. From my understanding, the boy is still attending school. He has not been suspended, but yet he's been charged with a hate crime. Now, this was actually in the city of, it was a Naperville Central High School. And about a couple of weeks ago, this same city of Naperville had an incident where in a Buffalo Wild Wings, there was a man who was known to complain about sitting next to black people in the restaurant. And I guess apparently a couple of weeks ago when this incident happened, the customers that this person complained about, who was white, the customers who were non-white black people complained about it, and it was reported on the news about this incident. So the Buffalo Wild Wings manager had asked the non-white black people to move, and it became a big incident in on the news. But Naperville has been like this, you know, for a while. I'm actually surprised, reading Sundown Towns. James Lowen, I don't think he has Naperville in his list of Sundown Towns. What's also interesting is Naperville last year, from a recent publication, was one of the top five cities, I believe, in Illinois to raise a family. So that's all I had right now in my life.
Mm-hmm. Just posted the report. They said the principal is getting
the two friends together and coordinating an apology. Always got to end these with an apology. Wouldn't be correct if they didn't do that. Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I'm going to start out with some local reports, really just two. The first is that they, at the University of Florida, they reopened what they call the Black Institute, the Student Union Institute, and they put it next to the Hispanic Student Union Institute, which is very interesting. And apparently someone at the university wanted to just put it all together, but there was protests on keeping them separate. And my next one is there was also during the ribbon cutting ceremony, there was some Black students in a van heading to the event, and apparently some white people or white students in a vehicle next to them called them nigger on the local TV station or news report station. On their Facebook page, they posted that article, and they haven't found the suspected racist yet. And on the audio segments, I was thinking about two questions I would have asked the lady that was talking about the, I think she said it was the white nationalism toolkit or something like that. She said that, oh, well, if these young people or children, if they're already, I guess, involved in white nationalism or something, then it wouldn't work. I would say, well, how would you be able to tell the difference? How would you be able to tell the difference between someone who's into white nationalism than someone who isn't? That you could use it on. I'm not sure what that would mean or what it means to me when she says that. My next one would be like, what's examples can you show me that this has worked? That would be two questions I have for her. And for the lacrosse incident, well, I think that was a Black student. They said white children or the white teenagers or whatever, they were stomping their cleats on them or something like that and said that we don't want you to outshine us. Definitely racist terrorism there. And then there was another segment that was on there. I can't think of it now, but once I do, I'll see if I can get in a little later. And that's all I have for now. Thank you very much.
Much obliged to caller in Florida. The lacrosse incident, that reminded me of Syracuse, Jim Brown. Yeah, I thought that was important as well. Terrorism, call things by their proper name. We don't want you to outshine us. Go back to playing football, coon. Not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. I think he said his mother said that they got upset because he took pride in his uniform. We don't want you having Black self-respect coming out here playing lacrosse. What? Go back over there. Put him in where's the remedial classes at? We don't even allow Black students. Aren't supposed to be here. This is supposed to be a private academy. That's why I say with so many of those school incident reports that, man, I lost it. Again, when you play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. Make sure you have that plan, your child's academic program, the first 10 years, first 15 years, plan it out. If not, there you go. That'll be your child stomped on with the cleats. That's what Paul Robeson said, didn't he? We read that. That's in the book club. He said they stomped on his hand with the cleats, ripped his fingernail off. That's progress. Syracuse. Oh, that was Rutgers. I thought we were same school. That was Rutgers. But Syracuse, Jim Brown, the great football player. He played both football and lacrosse at Syracuse. I know he encountered a lot of racism with football. I'm not sure about lacrosse. That, I said, got accepted. I toured Syracuse. They showed us Jim Brown, where they retired his football jersey and lacrosse jersey. I think it's 44, I think, at Syracuse. Like, yeah, I was all excited. Gonna go, maybe gonna go to Syracuse. Orangeman, it's cold up there. Other folks who dialed in, if we've not heard you at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
My perk.
Thomas in New York, were you able to get feedback from your daughter? She heard Laura Wexler, I think. Was that a waste of time, constructive? Did y'all have any follow-up from that?
She said she listened, and she didn't have a lot of questions. She just said, she thought that the lady was being deceitful. You know, so I gave her a few other programs to listen to. Hopefully she does, you know, but I don't want to push it on her because then it pushes them away. But I guess I've been probably talking about it a lot, calling every day, talking about what's going on. And I think it's starting to get on her nerves. So I'm going to, you know, just playing it by ear, Gus. But yeah, she did listen. I don't think she's I think she's just processing it, you know. The whole system. I did have that story that Henry just spoke about written down, and I thought that was interesting. White kids not ignorant. And I believe you got to use your parents' credit card probably to do a Craigslist ad. I wonder if the parents had knowledge of that. Reading as opposed to watching television, as you always say, Gus. NBC reported this week that the screenwriter for the Harriet Tubman movie had the same script in 1994, where Harriet Tubman was supposed to be played by Julia Roberts. that would have been probably an Oscar-winning performance for her. And I've heard that this movie has a black slave catcher, which I don't think is historically accurate. I think I've said it before, the day they put her face on a $10 or $20 bill, it's going to be catastrophic. Wait until you see the visuals. Prince Andrew, I believe he's sovereign. I know his mother is. But either way, that's above law. They can't bring him to court. I mean, it's really just a waste of time. What they going to do to him? Who's going to go get him? You know what I'm saying? They're going to go through the British Army? I mean... Yeah, it's just a waste of time. That clip you played, man, the guy said, all we can do is hope, you know, hope for the best while they're confronting white ignorance. And we need to hope this generation of whites that will be in charge, of course, will change their behavior. You know, sounds like racist refinement. That's what that all sounds like, you know, not sharing the power. You know, the next group of whites that's in charge, hopefully they'll treat y'all niggas a little better. St. Petersburg, I believe that was Florida. Black lacrosse player hit with the stick, start with the cleats. They call it hazing. It sounds, you know, Gus, it sounds worse than when the gangs, you got to join a gang and they jump you in because they don't use sticks or cleats. You know, they just use their hands and feet. Like this was a violent attack and they probably should have charged them with assault and battery. Long Island made up of four counties. And it's the blackest part of the country. But it's tricky because two counties where the blacks live in abundance is Kings and Queens County. But did you say Kings County in Seattle is named after Martin Luther King? Not like King George or James or somebody?
Oh, yeah. It's King, no S, King County, named after Dr. Martin Luther King. Yes. Although it will, yeah, that's a long story. But yes, King County, Dr. King. Wow. Yes. Yes.
Well, Kings County in New York is Brooklyn, and Queens County is Queens. But wow. So those two counties don't count when they count Long Island. They only count Nassau and Suffolk County. And in those two counties, only 8.6% of the people are black. So. And they have about 3 million people, so that's about 240,000 black people. And it always baffled me, because I would meet black people from working and stuff, and very few lived in Long Island. I'm like, so many people live here. And but they priced black people out of Long Island a long time ago. They overpriced little houses and expensive to catch public transportation, higher taxes, higher insurance. So, you know, it keeps it very white. But I predict in the next 20 years, you will see more than 1 million black people living in Long Island, as the white people that from this generation of whites, they tend to want to live in the city. You know, they'll replace them in Brooklyn and Queens, and you know, so they could be closer to Manhattan. That's what they call it gentrification. Mike Bloomberg shows a lot about how I think confused black people are in the field of politics or in the people activity of politics, because he ran as a Republican endorsed by Rudy Giuliani. And he ran on the premise he was going to keep up the same tactics and back the police the same way. And he won in 2001. He lost the black vote. Black vote didn't want him in there. He won in 2005 as a Republican again, right after Eric Garner. He won again. And then he put himself on the ballot for a third term, which black people were totally against. He beat black Democrat Bill Thompson, barely. A lot of people said there was some trickery going on in that election. But now he's a Democratic presidential candidate, and the blacks I speak to around New York, they're totally fine with this. It's like they totally forgot about his 12 years as the mayor, which just ended 4 years ago about. So it makes me wonder, I said to myself, if Donald Trump had the same exact talking points and ran the same campaign with the same history he had in 2006 as a Democrat, would he have won the black vote? Because I pretty much think he would have won it. We don't seem to vote. We seem to vote for a party, you know, like a brand. And it's one of the reasons why I don't vote. I mute my line, Gus. Thank you.
Not voting. The number 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Again, please do not wait until the last minute. I will say confusion is lethal. I think when you don't understand white supremacy racism, I think sometimes it can be difficult to put those things in proper context and to even have a proper historical memory for previous conducts, your previous tenure in political office, how you behave towards black people at that time. I think if you don't have a proper framework about white supremacy racism, a lot of times that sort of information can be easily forgotten, which just makes the deception even more effective. Let's see. Other folks, if we missed you totally, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Imhan DC.
Yes, sir. Greetings. Greetings to everyone. I wanted to start off saying that white people do not belong here in America. They're not supposed to be here. The ice albinos, the albinos, that group of albinos, the white people that are here are not supposed to be here. They're not supposed to be in many other parts of the world, too. They're not supposed to be in Africa. They're not supposed to be in Australia. They're not supposed to be in the other parts of America, the Americas. They're not supposed to be in a whole lot of places that they are in. And all the religions, they've changed the images on all the religions to a white image. And they've also changed the words to words referring to white people actually being the gods of these religions. So white people are the gods of all those religions, including Buddhism. The other thing I wanted to mention was you were talking about eating better and making choices to eat less meat, eat more fruits and vegetables. It's a lot easier for me now that I've purchased a chicken and killed it and ate it. You know, since then, I haven't had the greatest urge to eat meat. And so if you're having trouble and you want to stop eating meat, maybe buy an animal, kill it, eat it, see how you feel about it. I wanted to mention about the relations between Black Americans and Africans in particular, myself as a Black American, or however I should be categorized, as a Black American in my relations, or my family's relations also, to Africans. So growing up, my grandmother had a lady from Zimbabwe living in the house. And so we lived, I lived with my mother and my father and their children, you know, my siblings, in the house right next to grandma. And then so I would be at grandma's house, and I would be at my mom's house. But so I spent a whole lot of time with this African. My grandmother ended up going to Africa a few times to different parts, and you know, now that I'm here in this city in Louisville, I've had a number of Africans stay at our house. Some have lived with us from a lot of different, you know, from different countries. I've helped some of them learn how to drive and stuff, and you know, just try to help out. So I just want to make it clear that I don't have animosity towards Africans, if I can make that clear. And I do say again that in order to solve our problem of white supremacy, in order to stop white people, we're going to need help as Black Americans. We're going to need help. And we need the Africans on the African continent as much help as we can get. And so I'll continue to request that help. Thank you.
Global problem. Non-white people all over the world are dealing with the same problem. So sharing information, improving communication, I think all of that goes towards solving the problem. And Paul Robeson was doing the same thing, trying to talk to Black people in all parts of the globe, non-white people in all parts of the globe, to solve the problem, work together constructively, solve the problem. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Excellent point as well that if it had been a 16-year-old Black male or female, and they had like they had a shrine to Nat Turner, they had a shrine to Toussaint Louverture, they had a shrine to Colin Ferguson, Black male, Long Island, Long Island Railroad, who killed white people, and Kosi Thondaway, had a shrine to Christopher Dorner, had shrines to all of those people, said, oh yeah, I'm going to go to a white church, kill a whole bunch of white people, love O.J. Simpson, do it with O.J. Simpson jersey. That would have been front page news. Everyone would have heard about it. I think they would have probably identified him. I think if it's a Black male, Black female, you'd have probably had a name, juvenile or no, because I think they've done that before. In fact, we read that in Gavin DeBecker, The Gift of Fear. They changed the laws in New York
upset about a black teenager who went out and committed those crimes. I think it's highlighted in the book. They went and changed the laws because they were so upset about crime. Then had to come back and offer another belated, oh, man, we're so sorry. That's so sad. Man, we've criminalized the whole generation of blacks. The exact same tacky. Let me get his name so I can be more official about it, because we just talked about that. And in the exact same location, no less. But they put a name. When this black teen was out committing crimes, they put a name on it. I think we would have got a name if they had done something like that. In addition to, you're not going to be charged as a juvenile, buddy. You want to behave like an adult heathen, terrorist? Well, that's how we'll treat you. Other folks, if you have commentary, if we missed you totally, proceed. Grant, if we nabbed everybody, awesome, other folks can share. We should have, talking about Harriet Tubman, and I certainly have not and do not intend to see the movie, but an investor wanted us to get, there's a white woman who has a book, The Tubman Command. It is fiction, what they call historical fiction, which I really hate, because that can fool a lot of people. You have a hard time picking out which part they lied about it. Sometimes they will take evidence, they'll take actual things that took place, truth, and then they'll mix in a little bit of fiction and move that, especially when you got a white person who's writing about Harriet Tubman or anything to do with black people. But she wrote this book, Tubman Command. It seems like it's getting a lot of attention, that in conjunction with the movie and all. But she's supposed to be coming on the program soon. Like in the next 10 days or so. So be prepared. That'll be another opportunity. And Azure Savage, black female. She identifies as transgender, but she's here in Seattle. She should be here next Sunday. Not tomorrow, but a week from tomorrow. She should be here. You Failed Us is the name of the book that she wrote. I'm still looking to see if I can get the audio. Man, the collective gasp in the crowd when I asked my question, and I was so thankful I found the piece of paper where I practiced my question. It took me a couple times to write it down to actually get it. As I said, I was a little bit dehydrated. It was a long day. I was a little bit tired, but I took my practice reps to get it correct so that I could get my question. I saved that even. But she should be here on next Sunday, so we'll discuss her book, Racism, White Supremacy, and why she would write a book like that about, again, the school system. That's what you can expect, system of racism, white supremacy, if you don't have a academic plan for your child. Let's see. B in Toronto, did you have additional comments? I know you were talking about the Jim Jones situation. Did you have any more that you wanted to share? Just making sure.
Yes, for the Jim Jones, it was quite interesting too. The other piece that I wanted to add, and thank you, Gus, is on the CNN clip that they had, I'd say approximately 20 years ago, one of the witnesses and defectors from the Jim Jones commune, a white male, he described Jim Jones as a black-haired light skin, which I thought was pretty interesting. It's in the CNN clip with when it's Soledad O'Brien, who was the interviewer, who was talking about the escape from Jonestown. And yes, one of the witnesses described Jim Jones as a light-skinned, black-haired individual, and which was really interesting because I'm looking at it as, well, Jim Jones was classified as white. He grew up in a white neighborhood. He had two white parents. He had white siblings. He's white. So it's interesting how now they're changing his description, or how they had changed the description to from white to light skinned. light-skinned what would have been my next question, but it was quite interesting in that regard. So, yeah. Yes, thank you, and I leave the line.
Much obliged. I played the audio clip before where they talked about that, where they said explicitly he wasn't white, talking about Jim Jones, that he wasn't white. The church, People's Temple operated like a black church, and, you know, the whole nine, that is said repeatedly, when people talk about, Jim Jones, which is important. Confusion is lethal. Before I get to our other caller, The Gift of Fear, mentioned a number of times this week, Gavin DeBecker. A recent study shows that an astonishing 75% of homicides by young people occur when they are high or drunk, so encountering criminal teenagers under the influence is most dangerous. Though teenagers are generally not as dangerous to you as adults are, some juvenile offenders, like Willie Bosket, acquire remarkable criminal credentials early in life. By the time he was 15, he had stabbed 25 people and been in and out of detention facilities and blah, 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 blah. And they just go on and on and on. And let me just read the whole thing then. When authorities finally released him, a jailer made the prediction that one day Willie Bosket is going to kill somebody. That prediction was doubly accurate. Willie killed two people, saying he did it for the experience. Being a minor, he was incarcerated for only 5 years, but is now back in prison for other crimes. Even there, his violence continues. He has reportedly set fire to his cell 7 times and attacked guards 9 times. I'm a monster. The system created, I'll say that again, monsters and monstrosities. Somebody says that. I am a monster. The system created. That's a direct quote, he says. The statute that allows the state of New York to try juveniles as adults is now called the Willie Bosket Law. So he didn't get protection. He didn't get anonymity. They named the law after him and then came back and offered a tacky apology. And I read that on the program. It was the exact same thing as Michael Bloomberg. Let me see. It's probably in my search history. Willie Bosket. Let's see. Apology. Let's see if it comes up. Because they had to go and then change all those two decades. I'll find that part of it in a second. But they came back and did the exact same thing with the exact same tacky apologies that, oh yeah, this harmed a whole lot of black children. Woe is us. And got a big picture of the mayor, just changed the name, Mayor Ed Koch and Governor Hugh Carey from the 70s, saying we got to get these Willie Boskets off the street. Let's see, the caller at 8724. 8724, did you have commentary?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I just wanted to give my observations on the Harriet Tubman, I guess I'm going to say, situation. I heard the audio clip that you played of the ladies talking about her requesting pension for her service in the Union Army. So I pretty much Googled it, and I saw in the National Archives where she sent in an affidavit requesting said pension for her and her husband, who was in the Union Army. And in that affidavit, she mentioned she commanded eight or nine missions. Same time, I'm pretty sure you're familiar with the Devil Punch Bowl.
Is this a site where a lot of black people were killed, lynched, the bodies were left there, and now like fruit trees grow in that area, but people don't eat them? It's in the South. I forgot exactly.
Correct.
Georgia, I think, maybe.
Natchez, Mississippi.
Mississippi, yeah.
What I found out is that there are several Devil's Punch Bowls all around the country. And this is around the same time, the Civil War era. But the thing that kind of leaves suspicion open is that I'm not familiar with her giving the details of her routes where she saved us. I haven't heard of any stories where, you know, of the people who went on these trips. I haven't heard any stories from these people. I haven't heard of any skirmishes on the way, you know, through these routes or anything. And And just considering that all of these devil's punch bowls are around the country, it just leaves it open for me to think that since she was working for the ones who actually starved us and killed us or whatever in these camps, I just think that she might have been working with them. It's just my observations. I could be wrong, but this has had to been the cleanest escape routes on the planet, where nothing happened. Like, no stories of people dying on the way, running into, you know, suspected races and them fighting with them. I haven't heard of any of these stories. If I'm mistaken, I am open for correction. And that's all I had. I yield the floor. Thanks, Gus.
Mm-hmm. Remember, we played a report on a weekend that was talking about that, and lots of incidents, Jonestown, the incidents, even that, like, that's why I say metaphors. Now, why would a location where it's reported that it could have been 20,000 black people died in this location, why would that be called Devil's Punch Bowl? Why wouldn't there be a more appropriate name to mark this, you know, spot of a massacre? Just total disrespect of black people in life and in death, which is consistent. I can't believe I forgot. I said there were so many things to play. They found a cemetery in Florida. It was 145 graves of black people. I had the clip. I had downloaded and everything. I was like, oh yeah, got to make sure I get that in. I totally forgot. That was exact. That's exactly what I said. That's constant. They came out, they had a big group of people, and they said, oh my gosh, it was near a work site of some sort. And they said, oh yeah, it's lots of these. You know, nobody cares about Negros, live ones. We certainly don't care about the dead ones. We plastered over this place a long time ago. How many, who even knows how many Negros are here? It might be thousands. But they said it was 145 bodies. I was down in Florida this week. I totally neglected to include. They couldn't have played everything anyway, but yeah.
Well, one more thing before you I had put your logo on the shirt, and I wear the shirt, and I have a lot of Caucasians staring at this shirt, and it just has the cow logo, and it says a context of white supremacy, and I the attention is amazing. I wanted to see if you could give out your Cash App again, because I want to send you something for doing it. If you don't mind, before you end the show.
For sure. I'm so elated to no longer be a Neanderthal. I can be like everybody else in 2020, all the other five-year-olds, and pull out my cell phone. My Cash App is cash.app/$TheCows, C-O-W-S, just like what you have on the shirt. I don't know. That is a little different from please treat me like a white person. So I don't know if it's exactly the same. Or I guess it's not, because white people generally will look and then they'll say, oh, I love your shirt, or something of that nature. I didn't practice publicly today, so wasn't around white people with my shirt on. But that has been my experience. They will generally, I like your shirt and want to talk about racism. It'll be quite a bit beyond just an awkward stare. Did have that white fella who looked like he wanted to throw his ice cream cone on me. Did have that too, though. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions, you want to make sure you share, proceed. Did people see that? The 145, we have people in Florida that are here. Did people see that? They found 145 grave site, 145 black people. Maybe they didn't.
Hi, Gus.
Be in Toronto.
Yes, I just wanted to add to that really quickly. Similar to what you've just mentioned regarding the gravesite, in Canada, in Ontario, there were talk of sundown towns as well. And there was a similar situation with the gravesite in Windsor, Ontario, where the local white farmers would actually steal the tombstones and create pathways to their homes. So they would lay them down as if they were tiles as pathways to their homes, so that it made it, so the desecration of the of the slave grave, where they would call them the nigger grave. This is what they would do, and then the descendants would go in and try to restore the dignity of those graves again. But that's what the white farmers would do, would steal the tombstones and use them as tiles for their walkways to their homes. Similar, interesting enough, with the routes of the Underground Railroad, Canada likes to use the image that, yes, they were a port to help free black slaves from the States as part of the Underground Railroad. But just to give some additional information, there were actually two Underground Railroads. The very first one was the exodus of slaves from Canada to the United States, like New York and Vermont, where they were free states. And this would have been around 1799 or so. There's actually a letter from one of the former slaves off of the Jarvis plantation, of which Jarvis Street in downtown Toronto was named after. His name was Henry Lewis. He was a musician. And they actually have his letter, his handwritten letter, in the Toronto Reference Library on the fifth floor in the special articles department, where you would actually read his letter negotiating with his master. I'm not quite sure if it was Samuel or William Jarvis at the time, but negotiating for his freedom. And then he ended up running away off of the plantation to New York as part of the freedom. So that was the first underground railroad. For the second underground railroad, which was Harriet Tubman, was claimed, a lot of the whites here in Canada actually ended up turning the slaves back into the United States and would return them for bounties, because a lot of the white farmers here also had plantations in the United States. So just to give a proper context, people like to think that Canada was, you know, helping out. No, they were not. They were actively turning back black people, and there were active slave owners not only in the States from Canada, known as British North America at the time, but also plantation holders in the West Indies or Caribbean. For instance, John A. MacDonald, him and his wife used to manage a plantation in Jamaica. So just to give a proper context. Thank you, and I leave the line.
Much obliged. Be in Toronto, just global system to really emphasize the importance of what she just shared. That is so common. Many victims being confused, thinking that there are places where there is no racism and there might be helpful non-racist whites. She talked about them using the black tombstones as kind of a pathway, sidewalk type deal. Global system. We had Blood at the Root, the book about the racial cleansing in Georgia, Philip Dick. He was on the program. He wrote, "All that was left were fleeting glimpses visible only to someone who paid very close attention. Not long before she moved out of the county, Lewis remembered, she was walking up to a friend's front door and noticed faint inscriptions in the stepping stones that led up to the house. It was only when she knelt down for a closer look that Lewis realized the path she'd been walking on was paved with remnants of black forsythe. They were gravestones, she said, from a black cemetery. Someone had dug them up and took them home and used them for flagstones." Now I'm just transitioning back to what I said about the Florida gravestones, or 145 graves being found in Florida, and I forgot to include this clip. By the way, The Independent, they have a photograph of a cemetery, grave sites, and it's got a squirrel on one of the headstones. Now, you can just say, oh, Gus, you're reaching. But we did have a program. There is a book called Niggers and Squirrels. I think it's Niggers, Apes, Alligators, Coons, Possums. There are lots and lots of associations with black people and animals. The photograph that they picked is a tombstone with a squirrel on it. Anyway, the report titled 145 Graves Discovered Underneath Florida High School. A Florida high school discovered that part of its campus sits atop a gravesite containing approximately 145 graves. King High School, probably named after Dr. King, in Tampa, Florida, is the site of the former Ridgewood Cemetery, which served as the burial ground for the city's poor, many of whom were African American, from 1942 to 1959. According to NBC News, the Hillsborough County Public School did an initial scan of the part of campus after it received a tip from cemetery researcher and local historian Ray Reed about the land's history. Earlier this year, Mr. Reed also helped identify Zion Cemetery, another predominantly black cemetery believed to contain some 800 graves beneath what is now public housing. The Tampa Bay Times published an investigation into what happened to the bodies of some of the people buried in Zion Cemetery in June. This is the third time we have talked about in the last 12 months, local historian Rodney Kite Powell told Tampa Bay Times. There have to be more. People have lived in Tampa for a very long time. Ground-penetrating radar revealed caskets underneath the land that is now the high school's agricultural program. Experts estimate that there could be as many as 250 graves lying 3 to 5 feet beneath the school. In a statement, Hillsborough County Public Schools said it would be delivering these findings to the county medical examiner and state archaeologist today, as outlined in Florida law. On the heels of this week's discovery, MacDill Air Force Base, also located in Tampa, announced it would begin an investigation into a possible forgotten African-American cemetery that may lie beneath its grounds. And they also have the school that they've been talking about, where apparently a large number of black bodies were dumped there. That's in Florida as well. So this is long-standing tradition, in my view, deliberate, willful disrespect of black people in life and in death. There's a whole book about that. Their price for their pound of flesh. There's a whole book about that. And that's in Medical Apartheid, too. We read about that there. Other folks, if you have additional comments, questions, we have about 10 minutes or so left. Ivory, if you have comments, you should be with us, ma'am.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, hi. How are you this evening?
Right poorly.
Well, God willing, it'll get better. I hope everyone is having a good Saturday evening. It was just one thing I wanted to share about, but since you mentioned the tombstones being robbed, it's just, you know, 18th century, 17th century, or whatever century they did it. It's the same instance of tomb raiding. We're just seeing the same thing. It's just, instead of there being gold available, there was, look, a rock with a name on it. So what? You know, it's a nigga's name. I can use it as my driveway. So tacky, terroristic, yet again. But yesterday on Workplace Racism, you all or someone mentioned smiling. And in the book that I mentioned to you as a recommendation for the book club, in the book it discusses that smiling is a physical, it's a physical way of declaring that you are not a threat to another person. And so when racist people ask you to smile, they want to make sure that you're docile. They want to make sure that you're either complacent with the environment that you've been placed in, or that, you know, either way, they want to know, I don't have to worry about this particular Negro being an unhappy Negro on the plantation. I think I got it all. So thank you, everyone. Have a great rest of your weekend. Thank you, guys.
Much obliged. If other folks have commentary, again, we have about 10 minutes. If you think you have something else you want to make sure you get in, comments, questions, anything else that stood out over the past 7 days.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, thanks for letting me speak again.
I wanted to clear up. You said you wanted to hear about my
Quell comment, the Black Rebellion.
Quell Rebellion. Yes. So multiple times it's been when black people start to say, hey, we're not going to vote for any of these so-called black leaders into, you know, government office if they don't have a definable black agenda. We're not going to, you know, donate to you. We're not going to give you any money. That's when we start having these people like, you know, even when his comments about so-called woke culture and some people have flaws in children, his comments pretty much about Trudeau and in helping to campaign for his reelection, even though he's a known racist who wears blackface multiple times. His wife gets in on the act when she says that black people have to keep their head down and heal the scars of racist. And none of them talk about reparations, but then they give black people that feel good, you know, they give black people that, hey, we talked about this and we are over it. Don't do that. To calm and make them tranquil and make them feel as if there's somebody fighting on their behalf when it's not the case. That's what I meant. I also wanted to speak on some other things that I missed.
Well, wait a second. You can certainly do that. I just want to, because since I did ask a question, the question was Quell Back Black Rebellion. What exactly does that mean? And then specific times when he's done that. Now, you said when black people, and I will just point out in general, now we have white people will come on and say, hey, you can't talk about white people collectively. And I'll say, oh, yeah, because they are collectively dedicated to white supremacy racism. But there'll be tons of white people and even a lot of non-white people will say that, oh, you can't generalize in that way. You just can't do that, that's incorrect. Well, for white people with regards to racism, white supremacy, I do. For all other things, I do take that stance because I just don't think it's accurate. I don't see any evidence that all black people or even like a substantial number of black people at some point came out and said, hey, we are not going to vote for you black people if you don't do such and such. I thought they said in 2012, it was a historic number of black people that came out to vote for Barack Obama. And in 2008, they said huge. In fact, they turned around and blamed black people and said we didn't come out and vote in 2016 because there wasn't a black candidate out there. So I've seen a lot of black people go out and vote. Also, you said you gave examples of him like going out to speak for Trudeau. That's not him going out to quell black rebellion, whatever that means. You also gave examples, I guess, of black people being frustrated with him or wanting reparations addressed or him not addressing reparations. He, his wife, not addressing reparations. These, to me, that doesn't even sound like what you said. It just sounds like he's presented his view or not presented his view on racism, white supremacy, VGQ. Many people don't talk about racism, white supremacy. And most importantly, the effect. You said it's quelling black rebellion. I observed very closely. The cows pretty much came back on the air simultaneous with President Obama taking the White House. I watched closely. We broadcast and talked about it every week. Thomaston, New York was not quelled when President Obama came out to talk about racism. He was not quelled when he came out to talk after the Trayvon Martin murder trial and everyone was, or many were dissatisfied with the verdict. I heard lots of black people. They were not quelled. Dr. Cornel West was not quelled. For 8 years, he came out and talked about what a no good, no count scoundrel. He said, Dr. Cornel West said that President Obama was worse than George Zimmerman on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. He was not quelled. And there were many other black people who were totally dissatisfied and said so for the duration of time that he was in office. So I didn't even see that as an impact. He would come out and speak, and sometimes that would make it worse. Michael Eric Dyson and other critics of his would be even more incensed about what he said or what it, sometimes it would happen on this program. They would call in and say he didn't talk about racism or he didn't do that and he's a no good coon and I can't wait till we get rid of him. And I can't stand, some of them are here right now. So that would be my view. Certainly VGQ, but just trying to go by the evidence, I'm still not exact. Even just the term rebellion implies like a substantial number of black people going out and doing something significant and maybe even dangerous. And I'm not aware of when that was over the last, or it's certainly not any time when President Obama was in office. And I'm also not aware of a time where I can say, oh yeah, that was about to happen. And he came out and quelled the Negro disturbance. I can't even, if you all can think of a time when that took place, let's hear it.
Okay. Well,
can I be heard?
Do you have a time? We're not deviating here. Do you have a time when that took place?
I don't have a time in which that took place because I was speaking on what was happening after his presidency since now.
Well, they said, well, wait a minute. They said, at the beginning of the clip that was played today, we haven't heard very much from President Obama. And that would be my observation. I don't hear from him every day. To hear him come out and talk about this, that, or his comments on anything, and hearing his commentary this week, was there a Negro rebellion this week? Did that happen?
No, it wasn't a Negro. Okay. Well, a correction. I mean, well, we always fight against the system of racism, white supremacy. So I would say that we are under a constant of rebellion if we are trying to be counter-racist. But there was multiple examples of quelling black rebellion. If we speak about Ferguson, if we were speaking about Baltimore, if we were speaking about if we were speaking about Florida with Trayvon Martin. So there's plenty of times where he come out and sang songs and did certain things to try to quell the people. However, you know, I do concede that you're right, that I can't speak, I can't generalize when it comes to black victims of racism and white supremacy, and that, you know, he does have VGQ. He can speak whenever he chooses to speak. You are definitely right about that. However, you know, I would say that I will try next time to choose my words to be more effective. And, yeah, thanks for your thoughts on that. Appreciate you.
Much obliged. I could be in error. I'm still learning myself. I say that all the time. But unless I'm in error, I remember when Freddie Gray was killed. I remember when Michael Brown Jr. was killed. I remember when Trayvon Martin was killed. I remember President Obama coming out and speaking about those incidents. And sometimes it would be Cal's listeners who would be the ones to call in and evidence the fact that, President Obama did not quell them. They are even more upset. Now they're upset about what he said. What's in the archives where that happened? Where I've just seen too many examples where if it was having that effect, maybe that would be one thing where if what I saw was, oh, man, I'm going to go and sit. You know, our first black president, I'm going to go back and sit. I'm going to stop my complaints, stop yelling about justice and black people being killed. I'm going to go sit and think. Reflect, maybe prepare for the next election. That was not the effect that I saw. People just continued to gripe and complain and just included President Obama in their complaints. Did anybody have other comments on this they wanted to get in before we conclude?
Can I be heard?
The quelled. Were you quelled by President Obama, Thomas in New York?
Nah. After he left the office, I don't pay any attention to the president. Oh, thank God he's not the president. Oh, man. But I find that it gets black people on, especially on talk shows I listen to, man, they can spend 2-3 hours just, that son of a gun, President Obama did this, and then I'm like, oh, here they go. Yeah, we're going to hear this for the rest of our lives. And he's the reason everything is wrong in America. You know, nothing to do with the other 40-some people who was there before him and after him. But I just wanted to say one thing. Long Island, back to there. It was an era where I could not understand why this white place had all these good rappers. Biz Markie, EPMD, Public Enemy, and Rakim, all from Long Island. And they were like, you know, who was the go-to people in that era? It was just odd. At this small place, you know, they, I wonder why. It's just odd to me. And also, they, a news report came out this week, the Shinnecock Indian tribe. And these are black people. In fact, the Old Dirty Bastard, the RZA and the GZA, and Flavor Flav are all have the lineage of them in there. They got pictures of them. But either way, this week they came out and they pretty much told the state of New York they're going to start growing marijuana. But for the purposes of making extracts and holistic medicines and things like that, and open their tribe to the public, you know, or their reservation to the public. So I just thought that was interesting. They came out this week, but they're the original people of Long Island. I wouldn't pay any attention to, man, I think we both said, Gus, like when he was out, I think we were more happy that Barack Obama wasn't president anymore than we got President Trump. It was like, man, oh, thank God, no more Obama stuff. And it's just been the opposite effect. It's just, and we can't get rid of him.
That is in the archives. I remember it very well. That is one of the, I am not an alcohol drinker. I had champagne the day the Obamas left the White House, and it is in the archives. Man, oh man. Woo! The years that, make sure I get in because words are important. Quell, verb, put an end to a rebellion or other disorder, typically by the use of force. Whoa. The force part, absolutely not. But even just coming out to chit-chat, as I said, the end result generally was the exact opposite. I've never seen black people more disgruntled and unruly about another black person and blaming them for all kinds of things. Just never again, never again, never again. Four more years. Donald Trump, no more the, don't have to listen to him at all. President Trump, 4 more years. That will do it for this week. Man, we will be here next weekend. If you have illustrations you would like to share, something has been logical that's been shared, drop an email and we can share it for next week. The book club will be here for Paul Robeson Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Oh, man, I forgot. Azur Savage, she'll be here next Sunday. It was supposed to be normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, but I have to teach next Sunday. I'm subbing. I was not scheduled. And then it was, oh, mate, we need a sub. I said, I'll see if Miss Savage, if she's cool with waiting 30 minutes. So we'll start at 5:30 next Sunday. Make sure I get to say that a few times. 5:30. It'll be twice. I've had to adjust the time of the program for Azur Savage. 5:30 Pacific next Sunday, 8:30 Eastern. So just 30 minutes later, that will give me a time to end class and then bang, get my headset. We'll be ready to roll. So 8:30 p.m. Eastern next Sunday, 5:30 p.m. Pacific. If you want to get her book, You Failed Us, I'm sure she would appreciate it. Support. Reading is more important than watching television. This is a black author. And it's not very long. It's like 80 pages. It's very short. And Mighty, that might be a great one to share with your children to say, hey, not just literature for black children, but this is written by a black child and it's about racism. It's on Amazon, but I think she'd prefer if you could get it from an independent bookstore. There are black stores that have it. Get it. But it's called You Failed Us. She'll be here to talk about it just 30 minutes later next Sunday so that I have time to get back from teaching. With that, much obliged for folks participating. I hope it's been worthy of your Saturday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Let's keep our brain computer working efficiently so that we can solve the problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. In addition to being buckled up and sober, if you are driving, man, especially the last 40 days or so of this year, because it's holiday time, they'll probably have sobriety checkpoints out, especially in areas with a lot of black people. Man, no cell phone, not trying to get any unnecessary tickets, doing just the little things to try to minimize contact with the Daniel Holtzclaws, Amber Geigers of the known universe. Make sure I get it again. Just now I'm activated. Woo! My Cash App, cash.app/$DCows. Much obliged for folks investing, supporting the program. 2020 can move in with a phone. Man. With that, Creator, remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect each and every time we are in contact with another black person. Help us to demonstrate, exude the highest levels of patience with other black people, victims of white supremacy, even if we think they're an accomplice. Help us demonstrate maximum patience with ourselves. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Do not be quelled. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. A victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.